Hello and welcome, ladies, gentlemen, and everyone else, to Ladies with Gumption, episode 59, titled Delete, which is apropos because there was, in fact, a theme of deletion in at least one of these episodes.
Yay!
Even though the title was already chosen beforehand. I am introducing everyone. I am Tatiana. We are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DC TV in a flash, and I am here with...
Jessica.
And May.
And you can find us on Ladies W Gumption on Tumblr, at DCTV Gumption on Twitter, at ladieswgumption@gmail.com if you want to send us an email. And of course, you can type Ladies with Gumption into iTunes or Google Play and actually find the podcast. Now, to kick off the morning, night, whatever time it is that you're listening to this, we have actually got quite a bit of feedback this week. So let's start with our beloved Shang, who sent us an ask via Tumblr. Shang, one, can Kara stop being shocked and in disbelief, TM, with anti-alien issues? I mean, passing privilege. But she isn't that stupid. That's true. Two, not impressed with how they're constructing the Guardian AL stuff. Three, I like Detective John. Four, the way they portray fascism and supremacists is a huge problem, but what did I expect from an almost all-white writer's room? Five, Rainey and Nia were cute. Six, do the Supergirl writers not have any sort of backbone to have one solid stance on xenophobia? In this day and age where blatant fascism exists, why do they feel that maybe we should just talk to neo-Nazis is actually a good idea? We've seen how giving voice to trash like that balloons hate messages. Fuck that shit. Extremists can't be put on the right path, and that's that. Stop trying to bring them back to good. And seven, they need to stop using Nazi lingo because it's triggering. Well, Shang, you have made some points. And
what was Nazi lingo? Because I totally went over my head.
I don't know exactly. I was thinking I don't know about the lingo, but I know that when that dude was saying like, oh, it's not fringe, it's more centrist, that part, I was like, oh, well, like a Nazi.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
There was some.
But yeah, those were a lot of Supergirl feelings, but I think that I mostly agree with them. How about you guys? Yay, nay?
Yeah, I definitely agree with the car a bit too, and all of the usage of, I mean, not just Nazi usage, but like white nationalist usage about like Earth first stuff like that, yeah.
Right. Well, we have a little bit of Flash feedback as well on Tumblr from an Anon. So thank you, Anon. We all know who the Lady with Gumption of the Week will be. Yes, we do. But can Seal get an honorable mention? The motherhood in this episode. I'm sad you guys can't do a full recap, but I'm super excited for the podcast. I don't know if you guys were planning to mention it, but can we talk about how worthless Team Flash is? I'm joking, but I'm not. 2 weeks in a row, they have let Iris's 5'4 self go out of the field basically alone. Lastly, Iris is bae forever. So, yes, Iris is bae forever. But Team Flash had very important mythological creatures to search for. So,
well, I will say that Ralph showed up this episode. You know, so,
Ralph.
Yeah,
Ralph. It is.
Give my Flash son some credit.
Ralph did what he had to do. All right, moving on to the Twitterverse. We had some excellent Flash questions from Camille at TarkamWatt, but we will be answering them in our prediction section of the Flash. So come back for that. But in the meantime, Swara from the Flash podcast.
Hi, Swara.
Finally sent us some feedback.
Podcast crossover.
Good day, ladies. Writing in for the first time, finally. Shameful, I know. Yes, it is. Only watched Flash and Legends so far this week. The Flash was certainly my favorite of the two. For the first time ever, it seems, even with the episode in which she got speedster powers that was overshadowed by male characters, we had a fully Iris-led episode. She was the hero 100% of this story, and it was immensely gratifying. Candace absolutely knocked it out of the park. I think this may be her best performance yet. Thoughts on that?
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Sure, dude. Yeah,
shorthand, yes. I do think she's getting better and better. You know, I don't know if I would like be like, literally every scene was the best thing she's ever done, but she's got, like, you know. She's got...
Go ahead. Finish the thought.
She's getting better material. material, and she's delivering on a material, and as always, she takes it a step further. So it's like, it's the best material she's ever gotten, so it's the best she's ever given.
Yeah, and I think, and I actually responded to Swara on our Twitter DM, and I was like, you know, I do agree with him that I think this is the first episode that was written to be Iris-centric and actually was, like, Iris-driven. Because I think we have had other episodes that were supposed to be Iris-centric, like the Run Iris Run episode, and it happened to be a lot of stuff that was not Iris-driven in that episode, even though it was about her. And there's a couple other episodes like that that were supposed to be focused on her feelings, but instead it was focused on other people's feelings about what was happening to Iris at the time. And I think this was the first one that was actually Iris-centric about Iris' feelings and driven by Iris. So that was really good.
Well, he also wants to know, well, he's also glad that Nora and Iris have finally reconciled and wants to know if we expect more of an Iris-Nora storyline coming up in the future, or at least to explore more of the details of their relationship.
I definitely think that they're going to explore more details of their relationship, and also there's the, because there's like the upcoming plot summary of episode 100 in which Sherlock reveals, you know, he's going to tell Iris something that's his suspicions about Nora, so I think that'll be something that starts with Iris and then seeds into, like, both parents.
And then even, like, next episode, the subplot with Iris and Sherlock, but Nora's also, like, in that group. So you're going to get to see more of their dynamic now.
Right.
Coming up next week as well.
Right. Now we've got some very exciting feedback from Aaron, Sir Macon Bacon, via email. So now this is like a tour of all the different ways that you can send us feedback. Is what we're doing. hello, once again. He said, Iris Westallen, proving she's the best and ride or die for the millionth time. She's crazy and that just makes me love her more. Accurate. If Barry was dying, she was dying too. Poor Nora would have been Thanos'd. Snap right out of existence. Also, Westallen getting their first dance was sweet, and Barry just being so happy that Iris was investigating and wanted to spend time and date was great. Love when we see Westallen being best friends and helping each other when the other is down. They clean up really nice. Tee-hee-hee-hee. Cecile, you beautiful woman that lives in the West House, shutting down Nora was so good. Yes. And also telling stories about Iris and pretending they were Barry was so smart. I hope we get more of her being a voice of reason with Joe out of commission. He thought that Nora was acting 12 a little bit in the beginning, but glad that she came to her senses. Also liked the little storyline that Cisco got, but they need to give him much more still. Kind of mad he got a satellite working. We better not be stuck in that damn lab.
Oh, Aaron, I was too. He didn't get just one satellite. He got four satellites working. I was so upset.
Reading my mind. Ragdoll was creepy and interesting. Wish there was more from him. Maybe they can bring him back later. Ralph is so much better this season. Him swinging ice to the city was really funny. Accurate. And also him Kirby-ing that ragdoll was pretty funny. I agree. Someone sent me an ask, like, concerned that he had actually eaten ragdoll and, like, why no one else was worried about it. And I was like, no, ragdoll's fine. He was not consumed. He was merrily contained. But anyway, Caitlin's story is dead AF. Overall, Westallen was the best. The episode was great. The Westallen show is better than The Flash is normally. he thinks that the 100th episode sounds all right and hopes there's some good surprises, but was not impressed with what he heard about the crossover. So, well, what can you do? And then finally, our last for now feedback is from Renee, also on the emails. I love this podcast, and I'm super excited to listen this week, given the amazing episode of The Flash we just had. I feel like all of this, all of the feedback was on The Flash, minus Shang. I'm sorry. Okay,
yeah,
because
we didn't get any Candace, Tasha feedback this week. Tasha.
Yeah, our era correspondent was AWOL. That's all right. We still love her, even if she doesn't love us. Anyway, I'm sorry. Back to Renee. Candace continues to be absolutely phenomenal and deserving of all the praise and accolades for her work this season. It really puts into sharp focus how badly AJK was treating her character and the poor quality of his writing. Mm-hmm. We always said, and critics agreed, that Candace shines when she's given quality material, and this season has been proof of that. Badass heroics aside, The Flash really delivered emotionally. My heart broke for Iris all episode. The writing gave her space to feel hurt by Nora's actions, and not 20 episodes later as an afterthought. Cough, season 2, cough. I love that she got to express her feelings multiple times in the episode, and that other characters validated and supported her. Barry continues to hold his title as best husband and best friend in the world. And I love that we got an episode of him relentlessly trying to cheer Iris up, which we've seen her so often do for him. Mm-hmm. I'm also appreciating the split of plots and subplots. Everyone gets better developed this way. The characters actually get to leave Star Labs, and there are less teen moments intersecting with family moments for no reason. Plus, it gave us an entire plot of just Barry and Iris, and I don't think we've ever had that in this show. All in all, an incredible episode. Can't wait to hear your thoughts. Well, those were some excellent thoughts.
Thanks,
and I cannot wait. Yeah, I can't wait to just rehash them when we get to the fun part, because I feel like the entire fandom agrees on this episode. So,
it might actually turn into like a full podcast of
sorry, all other shows. You can go home now. No, don't actually go home. Keep listening. Okay, we will say other things. But moving on to news, because there is a lot of it this week. First, in the DCEU world, newcomer Ella J. Basco was cast as Cassandra Cain in the Birds of Prey movie. So, yes, she's very young. She's very cute. Apparently, she guest starred in Grey's Anatomy when she was, like, a literal baby.
Yeah.
But, so, like, all we can tell from this is that they really went out to find Cassandra Cain. They actually did auditions, mm-hmm. you know, and cast someone that's unknown. So I look forward to seeing her performance.
And now I'm very Jessica excited. Can stop being worried because she will be in the movie.
Yeah, I can stop being worried now. And I'm so excited for her because that's like, it's a big breakout role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I mean, she will be in the movie and she will be Asian. So mm-hmm. thank you, baby Jesus.
Yay.
like the plot will revolve around her, basically, because like mm-hmm. I think like Cassandra is the reason all the Birds of Prey come together. Because I think she like stole something or she has something that the bad guy wants or... I can't remember what, like, the premise is, but it's around, like, the other girls having to protect Cassandra Cain from the bad guy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the
that's good.
DC movies I'm actually looking forward to whenever it comes out. It's like 2020, right?
Yeah, 2020. Mm-hmm. She'll be, like, the Raven of this group.
Yeah.
In other news, we had two promos for Elseworlds drop. So... on, you know, in the DC TV world, on Sunday during Arrow, we had the promo of Oliver waking up as Barry and getting kissed by Iris West, Alan. And Monday night was Arrow. Yeah, that's why. I was like, why did I say the wrong thing? Monday night, Arrow, we saw Oliver waking up as Barry, getting kissed by Iris West, Alan. And then Tuesday night during Flash, we saw Barry waking up and getting his ass beat by Diggle. So, as Oliver Queen.
Exactly the same thing.
Yes. Those are two equal scenarios. So, what do we think? We've actually heard a lot of, like, now we actually got an interview with, like, Mark Guggenheim and some of the stars. So, we know that the three-night event begins with Arkham Asylum and John Deegan, who is that, you know, the villain of the crossover, is rewriting reality somehow. And that's how Oliver and Barry get swapped. So it is Earth 1, and it's just like, it has been messed with by a villain. So it's not like there isn't some other universe where Barry looks like Oliver or whatever. He just swapped them. And no one can tell, except for Kara, because Kara wasn't on this Earth to get swapped, right? Mm-hmm. She comes in from another Earth and is like, what is happening here? This is very strange. So Grant said, that the idea is... Oh, no, this is all... Steven. Steven said, the idea is that in order to be the best
You're
version of Barry Allen...
Your life.
Huh? Yeah, I'm already swapping them. In order to be the best version of Barry Allen, which I have to be because we face a threat, there are elements of his personality I have to embrace, and there are elements of my personality that he has to embrace. So that's going to be interesting. And also, even though there aren't legends, the legends are not crossing over, there will be a cameo for the legends in Hour 3. So that means during the Supergirl episode, there will be a Legends cameo. In casting news, Kate Burton has been cast to play Mia Nall's mom, Isabel. Hannah James will be her older sister, Maeve. And John Cryer from 2 and a Half Men is going to be Lex Luthor, who will first appear in episode 15. So I feel like we have to take a small moment to talk about this, because I know that people have been ragging on Bitsy Tulloch playing Lois Lane, saying she looks too old, she looks like Clark's mom, whatever, even though she's only like 5 years older than him, and he's already too young anyway, and that's the problem, not her age. But, so people have nonstop talking about this. So I hope that nonstop people will be talking about how freaking old John Cryer is. Because he is 53 years old. There is no fucking way.
He could be her father.
And he is. Yeah, exactly. There's no way that he is Lena's father. Like, I'm sorry. There's no way that they interacted as siblings ever.
Wow. So,
there's no way that Lily and Luther birthed this Lex. he is another Earth's Lex Luthor.
You're right. How old is she? Brenda, what's her name? Brenda Strong, right?
Yeah, I think she's like maybe in her late 40s, early 50s, maybe.
Yeah, and he's like, he had him with
time. Yeah, he's like almost her age.
He got it like the dad.
This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. Well, so I hope y'all never stop talking about this. Because with the amount of time, the energy that you have spent on Lois Lane, you better be spending twice as much on this. Because this is ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, they have to have some kind of, like, you know, Lex got caught in, like, an aging machine that he thought was going to make him do something, and now he's, like, super old. I don't know.
He got plastic surgery to age 20 years so that he could get out of prison.
He was next to Kryptonite for so long that it aged him horribly.
I don't understand.
It's speeded up for white man a generation.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it wouldn't have been bad if, like, they had cast Lena originally to be older, but they didn't because they wanted to make her around the same age as Kara.
But, he's not even around the same age as James. Like,
right.
Oh my god.
Anyway, I don't know. So this is very strange. I don't get it. Like, is he maybe going to be in just, like... Like, if he was just, like, a CGI Lex Luthor and he's just, like, voicing him?
Right.
and also, like, John Cryer as an actor, from, like, what I've seen of the maybe half episodes of 2.5 Men I've ever witnessed, because I was flipping through the channels. he's an okay actor. I don't know. Like, his voice kind of reminds me of Jesse Eisenberg, and I'm not a fan of Jesse Eisenberg, so I'm just not thrilled about this casting.
I see. But anyway, moving on to better casting news, hopefully. RJ Seiler, who I loved dearly in Power Rangers. He was Billy in Power Rangers. And he's also, like, the best thing about this one show on Showtime called I'm Dying Up Here. Like, Sebastian Stan was in it for 5 minutes, and then he died. And then RJ Seiler became the best thing about the show. But anyway, he has been cast on Black Lightning as an awkward tech genius named Todd Green, who gets recruited by Tobias Whale after he's rejected for a research grant. Okay. So that kind of sounds to me like he's like replacing Khalil.
Yeah, like, Tobias is expanding his family.
yeah. Like, I feel like Khalil...
I'm very worried about Phil. But going back to John Cryer, he's older... he's older than the original, like, Luther from Smallville, because my Michael Rosenbaum was only 46.
What?
Wow.
He just got Michael Rosenbaum, given his mom a fighting chance to birth him.
Oh my god.
Anyway, moving on to DC Universe, Young Justice is going to premiere, Young Justice Outsiders will premiere on Friday, January 4th. So you can get all your winter solstice, you know, out of the way, then celebrate the new year. And then it's time for Young Justice Outsiders.
But do we know, are they doing, like, the one episode a week, like, Titans is trying to do, or are they just gonna, like, just drop the whole season?
I don't think we know.
I feel like they might do the one a week, because they're premiering one part of the season 3 in the winter, and then the rest of it is in the spring.
Maybe.
Streaming service, why not just, like, put it all
like
out
people
there?
Stream? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Someone does not know the meaning of words. And that person is DC Universe creator. But anyway. So, with that all being said, we are now going to begin the actual podcast. So, as usual, we have side A, we have side B. We recap the show with, like, one sentence or less. We tell you what we liked, what we didn't like, and then we crown Iris West Allen as Lady with Gumption of the Week. So, May's going to kick us off. Side A, Power of the Press. / It's Called Empathy Dinah / Midnight Meetup.
All right, so for Supergirl, the power of the pen, Colonel Haley makes a surprising decision regarding Supergirl. Kara writes a series of articles highlighting aliens in National City in the hopes that humans will stop being so fearful of them because they are trash. Unfortunately, the article puts some of the aliens in harm's way. David McWhirter directed the episode, written by Maria Magenti and Adrita Mukherjee. So, lots happened this episode. What did we like?
Drunk Brainy was the best. I feel like it's obvious how much the writer's room just loves Jesse Rath and the way that he plays Brainy, because they keep putting him in these, like, fish-out-of-water situations. And you kind of miss that dynamic with Kara, since the show started with Kara having lived in on Earth for, like, most of her life already. So you're getting all these, like, new experiences from Brainy, and just the fact that he's, like, AI android. Well,
He's, like, synthetic, a synth being.
Yeah, it makes it even more funny, just because, like, he's thinking in a very, like, logical, computer, scientific way about things. And it's just, like, funny, like, you know, watching him trying to, like, be human and learn about Earth's weird cultures, and that mojitos are actually very, very strong if you have health. even though they are delicious. And then I feel like his literal interpretation of Nia's request that he, like, find her, like, she's trying to, like, flirt, like, if you want me, you can find me, and he's like, okay, you told me to find you, so I'm going to list out all the ways that I stalked you and found out your information.
A stalker. The cutest stalker you ever saw.
The cutest stalker ever. Like, he told me to find you, not call you, so that's what I did. Like, I don't know how he thought that he would get from, like, all this information to actually, like, meeting up with her again. But whatever. It was, like, a really A-plus scene delivery from Jesse. And, if, you know, like, all the information that he found in her would sound, like, really, really creepy and really, really bad from anybody else. But because it's Brainy, it's, like, endearing almost. So, like, kids, you are not Brainy. Do not try that at home. Do not do that to a girl, because she will call the police. elsewhere, I love
that. Don't do it.
Yeah, I love that they're actually developing John's detective roots. It makes me, like, so happy, because it's just really cool. I thought that, you know, with him leaving the DEO, there was this kind of worry that I have that he would just fade into the background or into, like, the scenery of Supergirl. But he's actually become, like, really, really important in his own way, because, like, all of the aliens trust him more than they trust the police. And they're actually, like, calling on him to do detective kind of work. So it's really kind of, it's kind of like a comic origin story in reverse, because we were introduced to him as John Jones the Martian, and now we're getting to see, like, the origin of, like, the whole manhunting part. So he's now, like, the Martian Manhunter, or he's becoming the Martian Manhunter, and like, his whole, like, detective roots are coming out, which is really, really cool to see. And I like that we get to see that origin story from that point of view. I liked him and Kara teaming up on a case to find, like, Amadeus' missing stone or whatever. And it's just, like, that's probably, like, my favorite part of this episode, and maybe his whole arc in general, just him, like, transitioning from, you know, the alien support group into this whole detective for alien crimes or mysteries or whatever is great.
He could be, like, Supergirl's Veronica Mars.
Basically, yeah. Those are all my likes.
They were beautiful likes.
Are they all?
So mine.
Ones I only wrote down, so.
Mine are, like, copy-pasted from yours. But, no, I agree that the opening was just adorable. I thought it was, like, a really fun scene that gave us a taste of all the different dynamics in, you know, Team DEO, Team Supergirl, Catco, whatever you want to call them. Drunk Brainy, full of giggles, full of charm. I ship Brainy and Nia so much. I think they're so cute. I don't know what the Caradox is. I'm sorry. But I...
Jess said only the promo people know what Caradox is. The show doesn't recognize it.
Only the promo people, because all, like, the promos have, like, Jesse and Melissa promoing together. I'm like, yes, this is a couple. And then on the show, it's like, no, they're not.
They don't know each other.
That's why I thought Caradox was going to rise at the beginning of the show, but they lied to me.
They probably lied.
I was glad they called out what Brainy did as stalkerish, though, like, because, you know, like, you definitely shouldn't do anything like that. But he didn't mean it that way, and that was clear. It was very sweet. And Nia was obviously flattered that he learned all this information. Anyway, I thought it was cute that she was offended that he didn't, you know, find her or whatever. And then, but yeah. Anyway, they're super cute. I could talk about them the rest of this podcast, but I won't because there's not actually that much to say. I just love them. Okay. I did love that we got to see Kara and Mia go for the interview together. Like, we get to see, like, Kara and John investigate together. Like, it was a really smart way to keep Supergirl out of the fights, out of the action, but focus on Kara and how her day job can actually help people. I liked seeing her, like, you know, try going undercover for a few seconds. And it was fun how she, like, already was, like, she wasn't good at the lie. Like, she's like, oh, I'm here to, you know, look at the changing communities. She's like, what did you say you're here for again? Oh, well, I said I was here to look for the changing communities. Like, what was it that I previously told you? So, yeah, I really thought that was fun. In the end, I really liked her idea to highlight stories of different humans in order to humanize humans, of different aliens in order to humanize them. Because it's, you know, like, that's sort of the reverse of what keeps happening, where we keep getting op-ed pieces on, like, oh, neo-Nazis, look at the general life of this racist and how they became a racist. Don't you feel bad for them because of economic insecurity? And so now she's doing the opposite of that, which is like, look at this nice average alien who's not hurting you in any way. Don't you want to be their friend? Which is great. I also really liked the father-daughter reunion with Amadei and his daughter, whose name I cannot remember, Eleanor, maybe. Even though I thought the rest of the storyline was kind of garbage, so we'll talk about that later. But I did like the way they incorporated, like, the fear of the police, the fear of authorities in the alien community. Like, they feel, you know, persecuted by, or they don't feel protected by the agencies that are supposed to protect them as U.S. citizens, which I thought was one example of like, a better way of them trying to do the real-life parallel. And also, I love that it led to John being, like, the new, like, their community's detective, like, their go-to guy to help solve alien crises. I think that is a great calling for him, and that he's going to do as good or better of a job at that than he did as the DEO. And it's allowing him to use his skills, right? Because he's no longer competing with Supergirl for, you know, most powerful being, since they're in two different spheres. That's going to let them utilize him to his full extent, which I really love. Finally, I loved Alex talking Jensen down, because he was a disappointment as a villain. I was not interested at all in Parasite 2.0, but I like how she chose to lie to him about being a good man instead of killing him, and that she saved the most possible lives that way. The fact that it worked, and that she actually gained information for the DEO, right? Because that's how they learned about the Children of Liberty. So, you go, Alex. You're a badass. The end.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you guys said. And everything brainy about this episode worked for me. Like, his cute drunk moments and how everyone was trying to help him, but also they were amused by him. And the fact that he took what Nia said literally was really funny. And now that they've seen each other, it leaves the door open for their ship to rise. And even though part of this will be my dislikes, I did like that Colonel Haley and Alex teamed up and worked so well together while it lasted. And it's clear Haley trusted Alex for a lot of the episode and thinks very highly of her. But it's clear that the writers want to give Alex her own adversary and not another mentor. I like that Alex followed her gut and that she wasn't so quick to try and shoot Jensen, but tried to talk him down instead. And it was clearly meant to show how differently she operates versus Haley, even though it didn't work out in her favor later, command-wise anyway. And finally, I like that Kara had a mentor moment and brought Nia along with her for the interview for some firsthand experience on the job. And I love that Jean is now a private investigator of sorts to the alien population because they're scared and he's resourceful. And I'm glad they're really trying to give him a storyline. And I think this really fits in with who he is as a person and will give him the opportunity to help his community the way that he wants to help them. What do we not like?
I don't know if it's like a clear dislike, because clearly I feel like I missed large chunks of previous episodes. It's like I was watching the previous on, I'm like 90% of this previous on was stuff I had not seen previously on Supergirl. So I don't really know, like, I guess last week when you actually saw Colonel Haley at the end, because I don't remember seeing that, but or seeing Jensen with the parasite being put in his ear. But anyway, so I was a little bit confused when I was
watching. That's a reflection on your feelings about previous episodes of Supergirl. Because it didn't happen.
I guess I was totally confused. Like, when did this happen? I don't remember. But I was, you know, I was really, you know, disappointed that Colonel Haley is a xenophobe and that she, you know, like, when her real feelings came out, because she thought that Alex was a fellow alien-hating human, and, you know, she decided to trash John. That was really disappointing because she feels like a little Amanda Waller-ish in the way that she runs things, and it seemed like she and Alex were vibing, like, professionally, strategically, like, they understood each other and they worked well together. So at the end, for her to come out and, you know, trash talk John and be a little bit xenophobic, I was like, oh, that's sad. So, you know, they won't be my new BROTP, so that's dead, that's canceled. I'm also annoyed that Supergirl writers think that one act can suddenly make people wake up and be racist. Like, so, like, Amadee's baby mama, whose name that I don't know, I don't even know if they gave her a name. She's just, like, Eleanor's mom, I guess. But, like, she has one bad experience with him, and it's kind of a weak backstory, because we don't even know, like, why he left or what, you know, what caused them to fall apart and him. And then for her to keep that one experience, for her to keep her daughter away from him forever, even though he's been trying to reach out, and her, like, physically, you know, on purpose, purposely keeping them apart. So, like, that one experience, and then suddenly all aliens are roaches. And she hates all aliens for some reason that I don't even know. And considering how they throw this word around as if it's, like, the alien N-word, I just feel like it's, if you're going to make roaches the N-word, basically, then you need some real plots, some better kind of, you know, I don't know. Like, it just feels like the plots around why, quote-unquote, normal
right. people. It's like anything to just make someone a raging racist.
Yeah, like, if something bad happens, and you don't just suddenly start throwing around the N-word just because one black person was rude to you. You were throwing around the N-word because you were always racist to begin with. So I feel like, you know, what they are trying to do with this whole roaches thing and the plots about, like, why, quote-unquote, normal people turn racist or xenophobic is just, like, really weak and kind of flimsy, and it just kind of trivializes the severity of using derogatory slurs to describe a group of people. So I think it's very, very white
approach to writing. How white of them, yeah.
How white of you. It's quite white. It's more of kind of like the both sides kind of stuff, which is annoying. And then speaking of both sides, and I think this annoyed Shang as well. Because I think he mentioned it, but, you know, James continuing to come off, I've seen a couple people on Twitter talk about it as well, James coming off as kind of like a both sides kind of guy, and, you know, maybe this centrist guy does have a point, you know, all this kind of stuff, and the way that they're writing, and the way that Picard is playing it, like, he just spent the whole episode saying, you know, I'm not gonna let you use me for hate, but his final rooftop conversation with Lena is more about, it seems like it's, like, he's trying to appeal to the racist masses and kind of like, let me see if I can understand them and their economic insecurity and all that other bullshit. So we can hopefully, like, reach an agreement. And I feel like it would have played better if he had been, you know, on the front hand, like, I'm going to play along with these assholes until I find the easiest way to take them out. And it was clear that James is not drinking the Kool-Aid, but it kind of seems like he's drinking the Kool-Aid. So that's, you know, I don't like that. And I feel like, specifically with James, and specifically because, like, last season when it was him being a black man being persecuted, he understood that. He doesn't seem to understand, like, the whole alien thing very well. Right. It's kind of frustrating. And then I didn't write this down, but when you were talking about it early, Tati, in your likes about how Kara was writing these stories to kind of humanize, it's a little bit speaking to her naivete that one bad thing, and it's not even a bad thing about Amadee, like, he didn't kill somebody, he was just had, like, a shitty relationship moment, and suddenly she's like, oh my god, I've ruined it, I picked the worst, because he wasn't perfect.
Like, the exceptionalism idea, right?
Yeah, it's like, Kara, please, like, if anything, that makes him even more human. That he had, like, a bad relationship, and you know. So, yeah. Sometimes she's just a little bit too naive or trying to like make things too perfect. So,
yes, I agree with that point about Kara being a little too naive. Like, I'm sure that if someone wrote out everything Kara's ever done, they wouldn't think that she was, that Supergirl was perfect either. So it's kind of like whatever. As for Lena and James, I feel like they're both acting in the way that, like, benefits the plot rather than really, like, coming from their own actual perspective or what I imagine would be their real perspective.
Yeah.
Just, like I'm expecting that James is going to expose and take down Ben through undercover journalism. But the way that the dialogue is framing it right now, like, you're right that it makes it sound like he really is like, oh, Ben had a point. Maybe I should look at life from both sides now. And, like, to the point that even Lena was like, what? I don't get it. But and at the same time, you've got Lena who keeps being like, oh, LOL. That's just fringe people. Only fringe people feel that way. She said fringe, like, 20 times. Which is, like, a super... It was just, like, felt like she's, like, one of those white feminists that just expected everyone except for her own group to vote for Hillary in 2016. Like, everyone's gonna go vote for Hillary, obviously. Trump just has bots and Russian trolls. But no one really feels that way. And then she gets there, she's like, oh, wait, all these people feel that way. Oops. So, yeah, I don't know. It just seems kind of like her and Kara's constant, like, surprise and, like, wonder that there is hate in the world seem really strange. Especially strange for Lena, who grew up with the Luthers.
Right.
Like, in your entire family like this? It's just your... Like, it's like that's just my family. No one else is like that. I don't know. I think that's a little bit weird. And also, yes, Kara was acting like a newbie in the world of journalism, which would make sense since we've never seen her do her job before. But since we know she's been doing her job off screen, or so we assume, it kind of would have made more sense for Nia than for Kara to be the one that was like, I'm going to write this nice story. And then, oh, no, there's hate. You know, like, I've never done this before. It's so strange. So, for Kara, I was like, I guess. Anyway, I just didn't like the whole Parasite plot, the whole of Jensen thing. Like, Agent Liberty suddenly seemed, like, super incompetent now that he didn't have Mercy and Otis around, which, again, goes to, like, why did we kill them off if we're just gonna have this, like, floundering villain? He put no thought into the injection, and then he kept being like he was acting like it was, like, really upsetting to him, but, like, what Jensen was going through. Like, he was like, I have no plan for what you need to do, but you need to fix it, Jensen. Because humans can't abandon humans. And I was like, what is going on? He just sounded crazy. And just, it just doesn't, like, I'm not afraid of him, or I'm not afraid of what he can do, you know? I feel like they just need to find out who it is, and then, or, like, honestly, they could just take him out with, like, one, you know, well-placed punch and then be done, right? So it just feels kind of like a flop villain right now. I was liking the dynamic between Alex and Colonel Haley until she was like, surprise, bitch, I'm a xenophobe. So that's done. Like you said, that's canceled. And I get that sometimes people who seem cool can turn out to be racists, right? Like, that's a thing that happens in real life. But, like, that's the thing that just keeps happening, right? We just keep doing this on Supergirl. We're like, look at this totally normal person. Oh, wait. They are not totally normal. They harbor hate in their heart because of a random thing that happened. And so we're not showing enough of people just start off, you know, people are racist, and then...
It's like, and then you cut me off in line for coffee. I hate
you still! Only aliens would do this! So yes, like, that's what it feels like. It's just kind of like, it doesn't feel like there's any real nuance to it. And I know it's like, it's a hard thing to play with, it's a hard thing to create nuance for, but you did decide to make your entire storyline, like, your entire season about this, so let's just, you know, step back and try to figure out how we're actually going to make the real world parallel work. So there you go.
Yes. My thoughts. For all that they're trying to make Kara out to be a great journalist, she did two things journalists should never do. One, publish an article about someone without doing any prior research about them. And two, act surprised when people say awful and racist things in the comment section. Like, her shock made me laugh, and I have to wonder whether she's ever used the internet before. Like, she behaved less like a seasoned journalist and mentor and more like a rookie this episode, which I thought was really weird. And I really wanted Colonel Haley to be a mentor to Alex and have them eventually maybe become friends at some point beyond just professional colleagues. So the fact that she hates aliens is really upsetting. Like everyone, like you guys said, everyone can't hate aliens, right? Where are the people who don't? I also didn't like the fact that Amadei's former girlfriend was so quick to become a xenophobe, like you guys already said, just because her heart was broken. She went to extreme lengths to keep her daughter away from him and lied about it, only to reveal herself as being an asshole whose hatred came before anything else. So her reasons weren't valid for being hateful, no matter how you spin it, and I wish they'd really just stop. Like, we need more alien point of views. How can Supergirl continue with the story if we're not shown any of the aliens having a perspective? So I'm starting to really feel like this whole season is a both sides op-ed and a skewed one at that. And finally, James. It just looks really bad that he's the one to somehow end up working with Agent Liberty, no matter what the reason is. Like, first and foremost, he's the head of CatCo, and even having a meeting with him, even when he doesn't know who he is bad. Like, bad optics, bad decision-making, bad judgment and reasoning, and I already hate it, and it's only already begun, so I hope they spin it differently later on. Otherwise, it's just not a good look. But moving into predictions, what do we think is going to happen in the upcoming episodes?
Coffee? Nope.
Silence. Nothing is going to happen.
Yeah, I think nothing will happen, no. I do think that James's plan is really going to be to go undercover and, you know, reach the head of the operation before turning on them, in which case I'll be thrilled, except that that head is Sam, and he's already Sam. What's that? The character's name is Ben.
Yeah.
Okay, it's like, yeah, is Ben, so he, like, already knows him and is, can be chummy with him, so I don't know. I don't feel like that can go very long. But if Lena really is going to be his co-pilot, then that could be a lot of fun. So I have hope that Supergirl is not going to actually make James or Lena decide that genocidal maniacs are people, too. So I do think that it's going to be, like, you know, an about-face where James gets close with them, and then at the very last second, it's, like, stabbed in the back, right? So that's what I hope. And that's all I got.
Yeah, but I think that he is going to be like, oh, homicidal maniacs are people too, and I'm not as optimistic as you. James is going to be like, surprise, bitch. I feel like he's going to be like, I can save you.
Kinda. Oh, God. Gross.
I'm not really looking forward to
the good in you.
I mean, no. He did have to be convinced by Nia that he should take a stand, so I'm kind of with Jess on this.
Yeah.
Haters. Haters.
But I love your optimism and hope that it goes that way.
Thank you. Supergirl's about optimism, okay?
You and Char are, like, staying away from trolls on the internet. Negativity.
Alright, I have no predictions. I'm just kind of riding the wave. Moving into Arrow, our recap is Felicity discovers a secret about Oliver and Curtis goes undercover. That was basically the whole episode. So she learns that Oliver is being locked up in level 2, and that level 2 is very bad. So she recruits Dinah and Laurel to help her try to get him out legally and, you know, without trying to do anything crazy. And meanwhile, Diggle asks Curtis to go undercover for Argus, and Curtis almost botches the whole thing up. Mark Bunting directed the episode written by Benjamin Robb and Derek A. Hughes, who used to be writers on The Flash. So what did we like about this episode?
It's kind of funny, like, Dinah, Laurel, and Felicity were trying to get Oliver out legally through illegal means.
Yes.
Speaking of them, like, I liked Team Dialericity. I'm not down with Team Felicity. Like, we're gonna have to change that name. But I like Team Dialericity. Because that's my new OT3. I thought it was a really solid girl team up. And I like the continuation of, like, the partnership / growing friendship between Laurel and Felicity. Because it started last episode when they teamed up together to take on the Silencer. And Laurel held Felicity back. And then this time, it's still Laurel holding Felicity back. Or, like, managing Felicity kind of a little bit because she's freaking out. And so, Laurel, again, being that kind of support for Felicity while Felicity doesn't know where Oliver is and needs help, and the fact that Laurel wants to help, and, you know, it's kind of weird, like, how a year ago they were just, like, enemies, and Laurel wanted to kill them all, and now they're, like, stalking the Silencer together, and ranging pizza days, and, like, doing all this cute stuff, so it's kind of, like, desperate times make for strange bedfellows, but I like it. And I also liked how they both, like, gang up on Dinah at the precinct to recruit her into their girl gang to find a way to rescue Oliver from his short-sightedness that I'll get into in dislikes. But I liked, you know, all the girls coming together. Dinah and Laurel are still, like, angry girlfriends, like, arguing up in each other's, like, personal space. So my crack ship is alive and well. I love that. I just love their dynamic so much. And, like, yes, Felicity, let's establish this whole, like, friend date thing so that when Laurel, like, finally asks Dinah how she can appear, like totes cash. Like, she's, like, a friendly today. I'm going to ride my crack ship until the wheels fall off, y'all. I don't even know what to call them. Like, I don't know. It's just my Blackbird's crack ship, so.
Oh, I like that ship name.
Let me have my fun. Like, other stuff happened in this episode that, you know, whatever. But, like, the best thing I think about the Oliver-Talia team-up were the fight sequences. And I feel like we say this every episode, but the fight choreography is just, like, one of the best things about the show, period. Like, the hallway fight this episode was really, really nice. And then I like that the OT3 Dilericity were able to come up with a really good and plausible way to get Oliver out of jail that didn't, like, involve actually, like, physically breaking him out illegally. They actually found, like, a nice legal way to get him out.
Right,
that all three ladies, yeah, it played to every lady's strength. So that was really, really good.
I agree with this. I guess this is, you know, for the prison storyline, it's like one way to expose the abuses and corruptions of prisons. So, Orange is the New Black, eat your heart out, because that's all I got for that storyline. I was not particularly invested in that. But I can say that Talia as the demon made sense. She's cool. I didn't really know her before because I clearly did not watch her episodes. But I liked the actress, and her performance in this episode made it easier for me to believe that she would align herself with Diaz. I was like, I understand where your desperation is coming from, even though I don't actually get it logically because Diaz is dumb and you could easily take him out. As shown in the end when she takes out the psychiatrist guy, I feel like you just do that to Diaz and he wouldn't even know it was coming. But oh well, moving on. The fight scenes were great. I echo this sentiment. And they are properly lit, unlike other shows. And not properly lit, they're fight scenes. So, 4 for you, Arrow. Felicity's desperation, you know, looking for her husband, like when she goes to visit the prison, that reminded me, I was like, I can make a parallel gift set of Iris going to go look for Barry. Except that instead of Cecile's mind reading, she got that creepy sidekick guy, who at least gave her the information that she needed and kicked off the greatest team-up that Arrow has ever seen. Which I thought there was, like, so many great lines of dialogue there. Like, since Renee was not here, and I missed him, and that is a dislike, but someone else had to take on good lines of dialogue. So we have, like, Felicity telling Laurel she's scarier as an attorney than she is as Black Siren, and Laurel apologizing because she's still learning empathy. The word empathy is a work in progress for her. So I really enjoy that friendly banter between Laurel and Felicity, and I like how they berated Dinah into joining their group, and that they all used, like you said, like they weren't using their battle skills this time. They were all using like old fashioned research, their connections, like the various legal or extra legal in Felicity's, on Felicity's side, means that they have to get ahead and to get Oliver ahead. And I like looking like, so all of Dinah and Laurel's bickering is so much fun, but I like how they put it to the side the second that they saw that Felicity was really struggling, right? And then they're like, oh, Felicity, let's help you for a second. And then I actually did cheer when the news said that, like, you know, level 2 was going to be shut down or whatever. I'm not totally sure how they're going to succeed in getting Oliver out of prison or, like, how one thing leads to the other. Like, he was treated badly in prison, therefore he should not be in prison. As opposed to, like, he should go to a different, better prison. I don't know how it works. I'm not a lawyer, so whatever. But I trust them, because if anyone can do it, those ladies can. The end.
Laurel will figure something out.
Exactly.
Yeah, I really like the Dolores-City team-up a lot, too. We've never seen it before on the show, and I like that they were all pooling their resources and knowledge of their respective fields in order to help Oliver. And I need more of this dynamic, even after Oliver comes back, especially for Felicity, because we know the writers like the dynamic between the two Black Canaries, so we know we'll get more of that. And I think Felicity needs to be included in that as well. And I liked it even better that their work paid off and it wasn't just a bunch of exposition and they were shown actually doing the work. And no surprise, but I also like the jail fight scenes. And it's the only time I felt engaged in the prison scenes at all because I kind of zoned out when they were talking sometimes. And even though Talia signed her life away to Diaz, I like that she still tried to help Oliver for the 2 seconds that it worked. Tasha was right about her being the demon, and in hindsight, it should have been obvious given the name, but I was thrown off because the prison was obviously portrayed as an all-male one, so
yeah.
It was really weird. What do we not like?
Okay. This is going to turn into a rant, probably. Just like, Curtis was not my favorite person at all this episode. Like, Echo did a decent job memorizing sentences in French, because that was the script, and he memorized it. So, yay for memorizing your lines. But, like, considering Curtis is supposed to be fluent in French, and he's going undercover as someone whose native language is French, Curtis's French is pretty laughable. It's like struggle French. There's, like, there is no way that a bad guy, you know, the guy that he was meeting up with, wouldn't immediately make Curtis as an Argus agent or, like, someone pretending to be someone he's not. Like, don't write your character as being native fluency in a language that the actor doesn't have native fluency in, you know? Like, if it was, like, a movie or something, Echo would have more time and, like, maybe a language coach to practice his French. But it just sounds like an American trying to, like, bulldoze his way through French, which is basically what he did. Like, it was pretty, like, how do you even pretend like that is what a native French person sounds like? I don't even, like, I speak some French, but even if I didn't, I would know that that is an American trying to speak French. Even funnier was the guy that he was talking to. When he found out that the guy Curtis is playing could speak English, he's like, oh, you speak English. And he preferred to speak in English. So why put Echo and the audience through the torture of listening to struggle French when the same result could have been achieved in English? I don't get it.
They hate him.
They do hate him. And then speaking of ways that I don't like Curtis in this episode, they gave him 14 PhDs. That is not how education works. Like, what exactly are those 14 PhDs in? Like, I dare an error writer to list out every single one of those degrees and the reasons why Curtis decided to take each single one, because it's ridiculous. 14 PhDs, 6 languages, and somehow found time to be a bronze medal decathlete. That's just, like, too much. Like, you're stretching the realm of possibility ridiculously thin. And I don't believe you. And it just takes you out of the complete story, because you're like, this is a lie. This is fake, and you know it. Yeah. And, like, miraculously, none of those other, like, 13 PhDs that Curtis has had any kind of purpose at all in this series up until this point when he needed to do something. So it's just like, why give him 14? You're being stupid now.
Do they not think that one is impressive enough?
I know.
Right? One is garbage.
Like, between Curtis's 14 PhDs and Caitlin's 5 PhDs, the two of them should have cured cancer at this point.
No, I don't think Caitlin. I think Jesse has 5 PhDs. Caitlin knows everything.
No, Jesse had 5 regular degrees. But Caitlin does have a few PhDs as well.
Jesse is a failure because she only has 5 regular degrees.
Right. But Caitlin did have, like, I think at least it was like 2 or 3 because they mentioned it last season. I remember rolling my eyes.
Yeah. Like, anyways. Yeah, and, like, none of those other degrees applied before this, like, one, like, magic mission that only Curtis could do. And his whole storyline was just dumb. And his, like, visceral reaction to having to make a second undercover trip into the field didn't really make any sense to me. Like, God forbid you work in a spy agency and they actually might ask you to, like, spy or do some spy work, you know? Why are you so, like, his attitude just, and he like, nearly, like, tanked the mission to have a temper tantrum. Like, in the middle of being undercover, where he could have been shot at right there because he's, like, being obstinate and, like, not cooperating, like, Diggle had every right to go off on him because it's a mission. Like, the shit doesn't have a script. You can't, like, predict what someone's gonna say. You have to improvise sometimes. I'm sorry if that doesn't, the unpredictability didn't fit in with your schedule. You couldn't put it in your calendar. Like, he was so annoying to me. Like, oh my god. I didn't even, like, you know, fuck Diggle's pep talk, because, like, I didn't even care whether Curtis learned a lesson or not, because he was just so annoying to me this episode. And then, like, on the other side, in the prison side, like, Oliver losing the ability to, like, strategize and think ahead when he went to jail, apparently, because, like, how do you not realize getting sent to where the worst of the worst go after stabbing guards means that maybe your visitation rights get revoked? Like, that seems like something that he should have thought about beforehand and not have been, like, surprised later. And he did all of that without informing anyone, including his wife. So he just, like, went down the rabbit hole without any kind of life support on the other side. I thought it was weird that he was, like, so chatty and asking, like, all these questions. And then the guards were, like, answering all the questions, even though he was supposed to be, like, you know, the worst of the worst. And the guards were supposed to be, like, you know, really didn't communicate with any of the prisoners or thought they were below them. It's, like, for someone that is, like, lobotomized, kind of, and drinking the Kool-Aid that you're inmate 4587, you ask a lot of questions, and they answer all of them. Like, that was very cooperative with the guards. I'm like, I don't understand. I feel like it could have been, like, a different way to get exposition of the storyline, other than, like, Oliver playing, like, 20 questions with the guards. He finds, like, Talia, which was the point of his going down there, and not only does she not have info, he has no plan to get back out of level 2. So, way to go, Oliver, for not planning ahead. He makes a plan with her to get behind a mystery door, even though he has no idea what's behind the mystery door, how to get info from that, whatever they find back there outside. He doesn't know how to get himself out. Like, he, like, you know, really left out the fact that Dr. Parker and the guards in level 2 apparently have never heard of chair strengths, because he didn't have any. TVs and computers with all of their illegal activity in one place. Like, Oliver really, like, lucked out in this situation, because he was not acting smart at all.
Nope. Oliver not acting smart was definitely the, like, theme of the episode, I guess. I've been so confused. Like, I guess it's because Dr. Parker was, like, low-key hypnotizing him or whatever. Like, that's why he's, like, that stupid now. But I feel like ever since he got down to level 2, he's been acting that way. Like, last episode, even before the, you know, one fake flashback to William that has made him a robot that just kind of does what Dr. Parker wants, he just sort of was, like, super way too easygoing, considering that he had come down with a mission. I don't know. But with this episode, I mean, I wasn't, like, really annoyed or offended by the storylines. I was just, like, bored. Like, I don't feel like anything was, aside from the three, you know, from the... What do we want to call them? Team Felicity. The Dollaricity, or, you know, the Birds of Prey guest starring Felicity. were also, like, that they actually pushed the plot forward. They actually did something. They got Oliver out of jail. And yes, Oliver helped by providing that little, you know, at the last second, accidentally, not even realizing what he was doing, providing the USB. But other than that, like, we could have just cut out his whole storyline. Like, unless the Talia thing comes back later to be important. Right now, it was just meaninglessness. It was just like, what can we do? What can we do to give Steven screen time? And then, like, if you didn't know what you wanted to do in jail, then why would you have put him there in the first place, right? He didn't have to be there for 5 episodes. They were making a big deal about how they were not going to just make it a one-and-done thing, but they didn't do anything there to make it worthwhile. So, whatever. And then similarly, I don't really know the point of Curtis being an Argus agent. Like, I wasn't as annoyed with him and his 14 PhDs and his 6 languages as y'all. But, like, yeah, it's clear that he doesn't like this job. So, like, you didn't have to take it. Like, you could have made your... You probably could have made your own tech company. You don't need Felicity to make it with you. Again, you've got 14 PhDs and you speak 6 languages. I'm sure you can find, like, one investor. But whatever. So I don't know what he's doing in Argus, especially if he doesn't like it. Like, I thought that ending scene where he, you know, like, pulled out the gun and the suitcase or whatever. Like, the suitcase was, like, shooting them or whatever. It was, like, a cool little twist. I was like, okay, cool. You go, Curtis. That was cool. But anyone could have done that. It didn't have to be Curtis. And then he found that painting, and I don't know what that painting means. I was supposed to be excited, I guess. It was like, oh, yes, obviously it has a hidden meaning, which we'll figure out. But I don't care what that hidden meaning is. I did actually like his little "I suck at being with Mr. Terrific" speech, but I can't put it in my likes because it seems so disconnected. Like, you're not being Mr. Terrific. And then even the response from Diggle, right, was like, but you can't leave him behind, he's part of you. And I was like, but you have left him behind. You're currently working as a spy. You're not a vigilante. This is the opposite of being a vigilante. I don't know what I'm missing right now. Like, why are we going along with this line of reasoning? It was very strange. Someone just get Batman a desk job. It's what he wants. Let him have it. Okay. In other news, Oliver reclaiming his identity at the end of the episode when he's like, you know, I'm not inmate whatever. I'm Oliver Queen or I'm the Green Arrow, whatever he said. I don't even remember what he said. I was just like, yeah, okay, thank you. Like, we knew this was what was going to happen. And it seemed so silly. Like, it didn't make sense to me that Oliver was following along in the first place, that it wasn't particularly exciting when he broke free. And he's like, oh, I saw this dude die. And then finally, I don't know why Talia is only one woman. Who's the only woman in the prison? It doesn't make sense. Where are the other women?
It doesn't make sense. It's like, why establish it as an all-male prison if she's just going to pop in?
Like one level is suddenly, you know, male and female prison. Like, that does not compute.
Right. Were those all your dislikes, my dear?
Yeah, just the last one is just, like I already said, I miss Renee, and I want Renee back. I know he'll be back next episode, but I can't believe we had even one episode without him. I'm disgusted.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I know Curtis was scared about going onto the field, but before I get to him, I do think it was a bad plan on Diggle's part to send in an untrained agent to go undercover. Like, Curtis talked...
They're fucking terrific.
Well, yes, he is, but he's not, like, a spy-trained agent, you know? Like, he can kick people's ass, but he can't clearly, like,
and let's be make honest, social connections.
Yeah, like he doesn't have that style. He is like Tati said, give him a desk job. That's what he's good at. He's not used to just like talking people up and trying to like convince them of lies. So I mean, and he talks even more when he's nervous. So it's kind of funny that anyone expected him to last more than a minute in the field doing this job. Anyway, that aside, I got really annoyed at the subplot. One, because it was boring. And two, because I kept rolling my eyes at the ridiculousness of the 14-page geez shit, which Jess already explained. But I'm sorry, it just makes no sense. And the Arrowverse at large doesn't need to tell me that these people are this unrealistically overeducated just to prove that they are capable and have something to offer besides their crushing student debt. Where did Curtis even find the time to study all of this? Like, in between hacking and being married and having a job before he joined Team Arrow, how did he pay for all the PhDs? Anyway, I mean, what was that?
So did he start his PhDs when he was 8? Like,
right? Anyway, like, they could have just made the dealer an Englishman so that he didn't have to suffer through his horrid French and his terrible French accent. And on a story level, I completely zoned out of the subplot and only zoned back in when Diggle started yelling at Curtis's complete lack of skill. And I also continue to dislike Oliver's prison storyline. He wants to catch Diaz on the inside, but his side missions feel like they're only done so that he has something to do rather than providing us with any true character growth. So since he's out of commission, the show has time to do that, but there hasn't been any real progress. And like Jess already said, he didn't think the plan through and only wanted to get to the demon, but how are you going to end up in level 2 with no way to get back up? So without Dolores City's team up, he would have been a dead man. Predictions.
I was going to predict that Tasha's prediction would be accurate, but she's not here.
Tasha, you have failed this city, this podcast.
Exactly. You failed this podcast.
She was 2 for 2 this week because she predicted that Talia was a demon. Then she predicted that, you know, they would find a way to get Oliver out legally through the whole treatment storyline. So she's very accurate.
I wish she was here now to tell us what's going to happen next.
I predict that she will give us accurate predictions in the future.
There you go. I mean, I think that the fact that Oliver helped Talia is going to have to come back around, right? She'll have to do something to help him take down Diaz later on. Just handing over the USB to Felicity cannot be enough. Also, I don't know that killing the doctor, if she did kill the doctor, right? Like, that's what we assume.
Kill it, I think she...
Or just part like, him.
Him or she might be torturing him.
Torturing him. But either way, whatever she did to the doctor, like, him not being there for the trial or whatever they're going to do is probably not a good thing. Probably not going to help them. But I guess we'll see. That's all. Oh, yeah. Anatoly is not dead either. He will live. There you go. Those are my predictions.
Those are good predictions. I approve.
Thank you.
Moving into Legends of Tomorrow, when the Legends discover that kids at a summer camp have disappeared, Sarah, Ava, Ray, and Constantine find themselves as the new camp counselors. At camp, Ava struggles to get along with the kids, but Constantine whips up a potion that helps Sarah and Ava bond with the children. Luckily, the team finds clues to the whereabouts of the missing kids, but the battle to save them leaves one member in bad shape. Meanwhile, Rory and Zari are tasked with watching the fugitive and Rory... The fugitive, Charlie. And Rory finds a kid... finds a kinship with their prisoner. Flubbing this. All right, what do we like?
All right. Well, I thought it was a very cute episode. I enjoyed it. I think that Sarah bringing Ava to summer camp after watching Swamp Thing together was very, very cute. I really liked where the relationship was at right now. And I especially liked how we saw it sort of like deepened this episode, how Sarah helped Ava open up and experience a real childhood. And I liked how they introduced that insecurity of Ava's. It felt really natural. It fit in with her character. And it contrasted nicely with Sarah's, like, idealized version of childhood that I didn't even know she had, because the only thing I remembered about their childhood was that they both liked Oliver Queen. So I'm very glad that other things happened to them. but I also, her idea to become a kid was also a great sign of her leadership skills, and the way that she reached out to Ava outside of them being in love is also how a leader should be. So I like that we got to see a little bit more of that side of her. And speaking of their love, I really liked their kiss. I thought it was cute that it was like, oh, you're going to have your first kiss, you know, as a teenager. And then also, you know, now it's now growing into their mature adult love. So, yeah. Also, their fight when they were, like, little girls fighting the studio was great. I like that. Meanwhile, on the other hand, we had Ray and Constantine, who also work great as a pairing, I thought. I like how there was the soft versus hard, you know, like the tough guy thing that Constantine and Ava had going on versus just like the soft and fluffy Sarah and Ray side of things. But that no matter how they went about dealing with the kids, right, whether they were like putting like little magical spells everywhere or whether they were like sitting in the bed at 6 o'clock or, you know, popping gum in their face or trying to do trust falls and teaching them about tracking, their goal was the safety of the children. Like, they all prioritized the children to the point that Constantine nearly died to save them. Right? And that was, his little bit was a really insightful look into his past, a nice reminder of Astra without actually bringing up Astra. And then, of course, we saw the guilt that he feels. Like, now we know he feels some additional guilt, right? Some other person that has died because of him, that I'm sure we're going to learn more about. But which, you know, that sparked intrigue in me. And I'm so glad none of the kids died, because I was worried. I thought they were goners. And I was like, well, that's going to make me really sad. Thankfully not. Also, I thought that the camp director, who, like, could not give a shit about whether kids were alive or what they were up to, was really, I don't know, was like, what? But it was very, very Legends, I feel. Like, because, yes, sure, people feel that way inside, but, like, there's also parents and, like, communities that are going to sue you or arrest you if you're just like, well, I don't know where the fuck the kids went. What, are you paying me to watch them? So, so I don't know, I thought that was just funny. It's like, okay, lady. And they did make you think she was going to be the, you know, the monster, and then it turned out to be Chad with his 90s jokes. Should have tipped us off, but yeah, so I like that little switcheroo there. Finally, I think that, it's two finalies, but I think that putting Conti in danger is a clever way to rope Nora in, and I'm so glad that Charlie is finally free, and that Charlie can live her best life with the Legends now, after two episodes of them treating her like garbage. You go, Charlie! I am Team Charlie! That's all.
Well, I guess it could be like, I do like that the storyline, like, you know, like you said, started out with kind of like Avalanche and showing like where they are in their relationship and the fact that they like watching crappy horror movies together in bed, and I thought all of that was cute, and I like how that led to the mission of the episode, because they happen to be, it's like a very normal way to be like, to discover that something in the past has been fucked up because this crappy horror movie is based on a true story. What? And then that's how, like, their mission starts. So I thought that was really, really nice, natural way to introduce the monster of the week. And then I did like the dynamics of, like, the camp mission with the two sets of counselors with Ava and Sarah and Ray and Constantine. Because there's just, like, so many ways, like, slice and dice that pair. Because, like, Sarah and John are, like, the rebellious counselors, while Ray and Ava are more of, like, the nerdy, like, rule-following counselors. Then on the other side, you've got Ray and Sarah, who are, like, super into camp life and all the positive aspects of, like, being at camp. While John and Ava just, like, suck all the fun out of the experience because they just cannot relate to being at camp. So I like how there's no kind of, like, clear-cut pairs that you can, like, slice and dice the characters. And it's all very, like, in character for all of them. So it was just a really good foursome for this mission. I thought Ava's overly strict rule following, like, military style was, like, funny in this camp setting because she's so used to, like, being by the book and being very strict and following all the rules. And so putting her in charge of, like, preteens led to, like, a lot of fun, humorous moments. It was a little bit Brainy-esque, which is kind of funny because Ava is kind of Brainy-esque because she is, like, a synth being, technically. So it is kind of like a similar style between Ava's comedy and Brainy's comedy. And it worked in both shows. So I like that. And I also like how we know that she's out of her element because she never had a childhood. And we got to see her, that kind of comedy, turn into a more vulnerable character study of Ava. And that Sarah was there to help her, like, work through it. And Sarah wanted to give her that child experience. It was really, really sweet. All of the young Sarah Ava stuff is great. I thought those two young girls were really great actors. And then the thing that I was going to note is that Sarah, she needs, like, her idea to become kids is great, but she needs to, like, update her references. Like, I know she time travels, but there's no way that she thought that, you know, Jonathan Taylor Thomas and Mario were still relevant questions. Like, have you never heard of, like, Justin Bieber? Like, update your references, girl, if you want to get with these kids.
But it was 1995. Her references were...
What's in 1995?
They were in 1995 for the kids.
Yeah.
Okay. I was
was just going to let her go. God, man. I was just going to let it go.
What is it with these references? But I forgot they were in 1995. So I take back the comment because you actually were in theme, I guess. yeah. You were, you know, relevant at that time. So that's good. So I like this scene again. It's like Ray as a camp counselor was perfect, and he's what you would expect. He's just great. And then we even got to see John's, like, vulnerability when he gave his life to save the kid. And you're right, like, the whole bringing back Astra indirectly without, you know, mentioning that, you kind of see more of his layers. And, you know, as much as he tries to push everyone away, like, he does have a heart. And then back on the Wave Rider, I applaud Charlie for, like, leveraging her magical knowledge for her freedom. Because I was getting tired of seeing her stuck in that cave. And then finally, my OTP of Zari and food is alive as well. She had a donut this episode. That's kind of sad. That's my only Zari mention, is that she and food are still in it, have a great relationship, but...
I know, she had two great episodes, and this one was kind of like, yeah. Fun fact, the review Ava was reading of Swamp Fang was actually a review from the AV Club of the show. and I love that the show is able to do things like this, and it's completely normal. Like, I also really like that Sarah figured the best way to talk to the campers was for her and Ava to become kids themselves. Like, kids are never going to open up to adults in the same way, and I like that they were able to do that, and that it also gave Ava new and real memories of what it feels like to be an actual kid. And Ava Lance was really sweet this episode, and I'm really glad Ava got some much-needed development because she's kind of been missing in action for the last few episodes. And Ava, of course, being a stickler for the rules, and Ray being a ray of sunshine and the ultimate Boy Scout made too much sense. It was really cute that John attempted to wear a costume to blend in, even if it didn't last very long. And his scene of helping that kid at the end was really good, too. So that was one thing I didn't add to my notes that I approved of. But what did we not like about the episode?
I did not like, I liked that Ava gave him the idea to find out the prison that Charlie was trapped in. Like, oh, that's right, you must be keeping her here because you're questioning her. And they're like, yes, that's why we're keeping her here. But, like, they actually had no reason to be keeping her here. So I didn't like that. Like, I continue to feel like this Charlie storyline is turning them into just, like, I don't know.
Asshole idiots.
Yeah. Like, because Zari would never agree to keep someone in a cage just because they're different. Like, that's literally what she just came from, that she's trying to escape. Like, I don't understand why they would have her here doing that. And there's, like, no proof. Again, there's no proof that Charlie's evil. She hasn't done anything other than, you know, annoy people by pretending to be someone else, right? Identity theft, I guess, is, like, her worst. her biggest crime. So, I'm just like, okay. And, I, yeah, so it's just totally goes against her character specifically, and I don't know why they have her doing that. And while I loved Mink and Amaya's chemistry, and so I like that we got to see them interact here again, even though it's not really Amaya, but, you know, the actor chemistry, it still doesn't make sense to me that he's the one relating to her. Like, that seems fake to me, because, A, he has no real personality anymore, so, like, what is he even relating to? Yes! Once upon a time, I did bad things also. That was it. And I like to drink. But he also was one of the biggest proponents of sending her to hell last episode. So now he's suddenly like, yeah, I don't like that. I felt like a cop last episode, so let's have a drink and then you can join us, I guess. I don't know. It lacked the heart that other plots of theirs that are similar have had. And while I totally understand constantly relating to Nora to himself, right? And like feeling like he's bad for people and therefore she's bad for people. She's like him. Therefore, they should not be with people that love them or that they love. Like that's cool. But like he's still right here with the team helping people out, right? So maybe he should just shut up and wait to see what Nora thinks. Nora's not even here. Why are you talking about Nora? And let her decide what she wants to do, when she wants to do it. And like y'all are going to say that Nora is not getting a say in her feelings for Ray right now. So like it feels like a totally one-sided. Like it feels one-sided because Nora has no side. But furthermore, it feels like we're being set up like this is a romance because Ray had feelings for her. And it's not even like Ray is saying he has feelings for her. It's like Ray is like, I just want to help her. And everyone's like, because you want to have sex with her. LOL. Jokey joke. But it's not a joke. So it's like awkward. Because I would rather it just be Ray being his sweet self. Because he would do this for anyone. And then if a romance develops later on, then great. But they're already forcing it so much without her even being there that it's going to be awkward when they bring her in. Like, she can't, can she even live up to the idea that has already collectively been created for her? I don't know. And yes, Constantine bringing Nora up to Ray was as, like, out of the blue and forced as Gary bringing up Amaya to Nate. Like, we don't need to keep, like, removing these women from their own point of view on their relationships, right? And it's the same. It's the same both times. Because every time that some other dude brings Amaya up to Nate, it's about Amaya being heartless, right? It's like, LOL, Amaya's heartless and doesn't care about you and you're a loser, right? And, like, that's sort of the same thing with Nora and Nate. Like, you know, like, Nora's heartless because she's literally evil and you're a loser anyway, so she's not going to like you. And it's like, okay, thank you for, you know, dismissing whatever feelings this woman may or may not have. Ignoring her situation and just talking about her when she's not there. So yes.
Yeah, it's like they're setting up the whole love story as something that Ray deserves or something like from Ray's. It's setting up like this kind of good guy TM kind of storyline that Ray deserves Nora's love because Ray is so good. But if Nora doesn't return Ray's feelings and she's a heartless bitch or something like that, and it's just the way that it's, and it's not even Ray's perspective. But the way that they're setting it up just feels like it's putting all this pressure on Nora to return Ray's feelings, because if she doesn't, then Nora is the bad person. And that kind of just rubs me the wrong way. And I'm glad that she, like, John, like, constantly bringing her up, because he brought her up twice and warning Ray to, like, stay away from her. And it just seems kind of, like, forced. I'm like, why are you bringing up Nora? Like, you don't even know Ray and Nora's relationship, so why are you speaking on it? And then speaking on it to the point that you think that you know how Nora feels, and we're getting all this kind of, and then, you know, add that onto Ray constantly bringing up Nora from the premiere when he's talking to Zari, and it just feels like, you know, she's being name-dropped a lot, and I'm not seeing her to see what the fuck she thinks. So it was good that we saw that she's going to be, hopefully, in the next episode, since you see her at the end. So finally we'll get her perspective, but just the whole, like, setup of it and constantly naming her, it's just, like, setting her up for failure. I feel like if she does not react the way that we've been set up to expect her to react to Nate, to Ray, to be like, oh, thank you, kind savior, man, my superhero. But, like, that's what I feel like we're being set up for her, like, when she returns and she finally meets Ray, that she'll be, like, grateful for him. And I'm like, well, that's, yeah, I don't like that at all. And then I also, like, I feel bad that I don't like this Charlie storyline, but I don't like this Charlie storyline. I don't like what they're doing to Charlie. I feel like Maisie still feels a little bit uncomfortable in Charlie. I even felt like Charlie, like, ran weird or something. It's like a weird dislike. I'm like, why are you running like that? I don't know. It just, It's not gelling for me yet. I, like, thank God that she found a way to get out of her cage, because, like, Charlie's been kicking at that force field for 1.5 episodes, and it was, like, wearing on my nerves. I think that was another thing. Like, she's been in this cage for, like, 1.5 episodes, and it just feels like repeating the same conversations over and over again. Like, let me out! No! Like, okay, well, that was that storyline. Thanks. Like, what else is there to do other than for kick at, you know, a force field for 30 minutes? I agree with you, Tati, that it feels, like, very out of character for Zari to be so at odds with Charlie being the rule breaker, when all Zari does is break rules. Like, I thought that she would be, like, a little bit more understanding and not, like, so put off about having to babysit Charlie. So I was kind of okay with Charlie, like, tricking her and locking her in the prison to give her kind of, like, a taste of, like, you see how you like being locked up. And I feel like Charlie could have easily had the same heart-to-heart that she had with Mick, but with Zari. But I guess Mick needed something to do, because otherwise he didn't really need to be in the episode at all. So I guess that was a reason for it. But I just felt like, and because the foursome at the camp worked so well, and Nate didn't show up at all, Zari also needed to do something. But, you know, I feel like there could have been, like a rebellious little three-way team up with Mick, Zari, and Charlie. But Zari had to be, like, the bad cop to Mick's good cop kind of thing. So, whatever.
Yeah. Whatever, indeed.
I'll start with saying I didn't notice Nate was gone. It's not a dislike. I just made an observation. I didn't realize he wasn't even in the episode until later. I also didn't like that Charlie was trapped in a cage throughout most of the episode, and that the legend seemed like they fully intended on keeping her there, had Charlie not tricked Zari into coming into the room. And while I like that Charlie had some semblance of control after she realized she knew more about the magical creatures than the team did, I don't like that she kind of had to, you know, prove herself in order to for her to win over the team and be permanently allowed to roam freely. I wanted Zari to be the one to warm up to Charlie and have them bond, because they both have faced hatred in their lives and have suffered because of it. And I think that that would have made a good grounding point for the both of them and a future friendship. And while it's not the worst thing to have Charlie and Mick bond, I'm still a little bit salty about that. Finally, I agree about Nora and Ray. We know she'll be back, and at least she showed up at the end of the episode. But if they intend on building up any romance between the two, it's all been very one-sided at this point, and that's not very good. Like, they're all speaking on Nora's behalf, and it's become a little bit tiring for all the reasons that you ladies so eloquently stated. So hopefully she'll actually come up and be like, I don't like Ray, you know, like, I want her to have that attitude a little bit, because right now she's kind of like a dream girl in his head, and that's not cool. Predictions. What do we think is going to happen?
Well, since no one else wrote anything, my only prediction is that since Nora hangs out with demons on the regular, she will know something about John's demon that she can then investigate with him on the sly, and they can have a bickering about who is the darker person. There you go. I'm worse than you! No, I'm worse than you! Alright, there you go. That's all.
I think that's probably accurate. I do wonder how dynamics will change. I wonder, because I feel like John's not going to like that Charlie is out and about now. And then I kind of wonder, like, Constantine and Nora, their dynamic going back and forth. But I don't really have any solid predictions, because we don't really know when the big bad is, because you can't predict, like, who the next magical creature is, and then you don't really know anything about the big bad yet. So hopefully that we will learn something about the big bad next week.
Yeah. I'm with you. I'm with you.
All right, drum roll. Side A nominations for the first runner-up of Ladies of Gumption of the Week, who is going to lose in the second round.
Runner-up. Oh, man. We've got Laurel learning empathy on Arrow. We've got Ava learning about being a child on...
I would put the OT3... The Arrow OT3 up.
Okay. Arrow OT3. All right. As a unit.
As a unit.
Okay, I accept that.
I like it. All right, so Dolorosity has runner up for Lady with Gumption of the Week. Moving into side B.
For side A, yes.
Cool. Side B, Respect / No Time Like the Present / Upgrades. Over on The Flash, Nora lets something slip about the future, which is really a repercussion of what she said last episode that still devastates Iris. And in an attempt to distract his wife, Barry asks Iris to team up to stop a new meta named Ragdoll. Meanwhile, Caitlin learns something about her father.
That no one cares about.
And Cisco has feelings. What did we like? This episode was written by Thomas Pound and Sterling Gates. They did the thing and it was amazing. So what did we like about this episode? It's going to be long.
It's going to be really long, y'all. So sorry, but not sorry. And I don't think y'all want to
But yeah, I think they want to hear all the things.
Right, all the things. All the things multiple times. Before we get to the likes of the West Allen of it all, getting through all of my non-West Allen stuff first, because, you know, otherwise in comparison, it's just going to be like, oh, and this also happened. So I'll get all the, this also happened out beforehand. Twisty Troy as Ragdoll, he might visually be one of the best Villain of the Week the Flash has ever had. Like, he was appropriately creepy. Loved the jigsaw mask. Knowing that, like, 98% of the movement was just Troy himself made it even better. Like, I don't even know if it's possible anymore physically. Like, maybe Trey really can fill this place flat and fit it through an air conditioning vent. Like, I don't know. Maybe he can do that. I don't know. So, like, he, just him doing what he can do was really, really creepy and really fun to watch. And I'm glad that Ragdoll isn't a one and done. So we did get, like, the bonus scene of him being put in Iron Heights next to the Weather Wizard. And we couldn't see him again as early as episode 7 because Weather Witch, who is Weather Wizard's daughter, is coming to kill her dad somehow in episode 7. So maybe we get to see him again as early as that.
Hopefully.
I didn't really give a shit about the B-plot, but I do love that Cisco got to steal some of the B-plot for his feelings, and that he got, like, a point of view, and that he had someone supporting him. And I feel like the scene between Cisco and Caitlin was really, really well done. Amazing. Danielle and Carlos, Carlos is probably her best scene partner. The whole scene felt really nostalgic of their season one friendship back when people thought, like, maybe they could develop into something more. Like, when Killer Vibe was actually, like, a real thing. That's kind of what it felt like. And I remember, like, on our podcast over, I think it was last hiatus, we did one episode about how characters of color, like Iris and Cisco, don't usually get the kind of support from other characters and narratives like their white counterparts often do. And this episode, both Iris and Cisco were going through something, and the most important people in their story stepped up to support them through it, which is really great. Good shit. Love it. Lastly, pre-West A, I stand Cecile so hard. She was, like, ride or die for Iris. She was not going to stand for any Iris slander under her roof. Her face when Nora started bad-mouthing Iris was just, like, perfect. Nicola's facial expression is like, I know I just not hear what I thought I heard kind of thing. She's like, listen, I'm not on your little friends. You better put some text on Iris' name. I loved it. And I thought that she was really, you know, you could tell that Cecile's experienced in being a mother, having a grown daughter of her own and a newborn. And I thought the way that she handled Nora was very experienced mother of her. And I thought it was really clever how she kind of baited Nora with stories about Barry that were actually stories about Iris to get Nora to, like, learn about her mother from an unbiased perspective. So, Mother of the Year. I agree with whoever had a non said that she was just, like, the best ever. Joe, like, really picked a good stepmother for his daughter, for sure. Now, main event. Barry was just, like, the best husband ever this entire episode. I love even, like, the little stupid minor things, like how he couldn't believe that someone could be inconsiderate enough to commit a crime in the middle of the day, like 10 a.m. What are you doing? People have work, criminals. So I like that. I love how ridiculously happy he was when he ran into Iris, who was doing her job interviewing that couple that was robbed on his crime scene. He's like, oh, fancy meeting you here. He was just like so happy to see her. I'm like, Barry, you see her every day. I love that he saw that she was still in a bad mood after the fight with her daughter, and he asked her out on a work date to cheer her up, and that led to a fancy gala, and he wasted no time in seizing the opportunity to, you know, get dressed up and make Iris look special. You know, they're supposed to be, like, working, but he still makes time to do something romantic for her, which is really, really sweet. Grant and Candace looked amazing, like, straight out of a movie. Like, their entrance coming in with the kind of, like, the slow-mo and then, like, showing up was great. Him asking Iris to dance was perfect. The dance itself was really gorgeous. I love how they slowed down time and kind of just, like, really focused in on them. The song was beautiful. It was just, like, it was the only, them two were the only two people in the world. And it, like, they low-key entered their own mini flash time in that moment, and it was awesome. And I think Barry did it on purpose, too, because, you know, it kind of reminds me of a scene from the comics. And I think in the comics, it was shortly after they got married, where Barry tells Iris that, quote, like, time doesn't stop, time never stops. But when I'm with you, Iris, when I'm with you, it feels like it does. And that's, like, that's what this scene felt like. And it was just, like, amazing.
That's a great line. I love that line so much.
Yeah. Gold standard, for sure. And I loved, like, Barry would not let Iris feel bad about herself. Like, he was supporting her. He was like, you know, even if future you does do that, I support future you. And even if you don't want to be future you, you don't have to be future you, because it's in the future and you can change it. And, like, I like that he was telling her not to worry about the person that she may become, because it's not the person that she is now. Because I thought that was really solid advice. And I like that Iris's feelings are coming from a place that her relationship with her own mother, Francine, and even when she was, like, comparing the Merkel mother-son situation and how that one was estranged to her situation. Now, like, she got to express that, and Barry got to respond to it and comfort her out of that. And then I liked Ralph Spider-Man speaking for the city with Iris. That was hilarious. And then, of course, the reason why she lays guns in the week, her diving off that building without hesitation. Like, she just runs and jumps because she knows that all she has to do, if she can only reach Barry to free him, that, you know, they will, that's all she has to do is do that, and he will save them and take care of the rest. And so I loved how fearless she was doing that. And then Nora arriving in time to see her mother do something like that, do something so cool, be so different from the mother that she knew. And this is after hearing all the stories about her mother that she had never heard before. So to see that, what she's hearing in action, and having that kind of change her perspective, and then finally starting to bond and have a real conversation, was just like the icing on top of a very, very delicious cake.
A very delicious game.
Well said.
Yeah, I agree. That is pretty much, you know, this was a feast. This episode was a feast. I liked everything about it, pretty much. Sterling Gates, Thomas Pound, my favorite white men. And I felt like Barry, you know, was back to his season one self. Like, he had, like, he was full of hope, enthusiasm, and admiration for everything Iris does. But I will start with the non-Iris things, just like Jessica, and just like I'm sure May will. So starting off, Ragdoll was truly creepy. I think that's probably the only time that a Flash villain has, like, genuinely frightened me. I think Phil Lamar did the voice, which was great, but Troy James's, like, physicality was what made the story work. I liked that it connected thematically with Iris' story as well, but really it was just cool and creepy to see all those different, you know, mashings and twistings and, you know, and not knowing what part was CGI and what part was, you know, the real him. Like, and in fact, maybe because so much of it was him, the CGI was really good. Like, I couldn't tell the difference, you know, so probably because Armin had a lot to work with since they already had so much of the real thing. So that's pretty cool. Any hoobies. Carlos was amazing in his storyline, which I'm going to call his storyline, even though technically it was not, but he owned it. He knocked the performance out of the park. I was really painful to watch, you know, Cisco sort of like literally hurting himself to help Caitlin, but that's exactly who Cisco is. And so I thought that was like a really, you know, like, it was just like a really good look at what makes Cisco tick, right? He always puts everyone's needs above his own to the point that he's willing to erase himself to help his friend, right? Mm-hmm. And he needed Caitlin to remind him just how valuable he is to people, like, as himself. Like they need him. Like, please don't kill yourself trying to help me because I need you around. Even without his powers, Cisco Ramon is meaningful. So I really liked their scene together, like, their big scene together. And I thought it was really memorable. It was a great reminder of how powerful their friendship was in season one. And yeah, and again, you know, Carlos is always doing his best work. But Danielle, I think, does her best work with Carlos. I loved Barry and Cecile standing up for Nora to, they're standing up for Iris to Nora's face, especially Cecile. Like, cause like, Barry did it also last episode and it was really great to see, you know, him be like, I side with your mom. Your mom could kill someone. And I would say, why did you kill me, Iris? But Cecile, this episode was a really nice surprise. I think it's so rare to see other characters, you know, lift Iris up, explicitly take her side. But this season has been hitting that sweet spot and has really been treating Iris with the respect that she's deserved all along. So it was really great to see Cecile lay down that tough love and sneakily share stories of Baby West Allen so that Nora would see why she was wrong to think of her mom the way she did. So I am definitely a Cecile stan now. She can stay. And speaking of stans...
it was kind of
Now I'm just finally on solid ground. But no, Barry stands Iris so hard. It is adorable. I love him. I love them. He was so happy just seeing her at work. You know, he just like really wanted, and then he wanted to turn their work date so badly into a real date. Side note, I love how he was like, medicups for me, tasers for you, and we could dress up. And then she was like, it's work, it's not a date. As if, like, that whole thing, like, putting medicuffs on him and her having a taser would be part of their date.
They're so kinky. I was like,
yeah, you know, that sounds a little kinky. You know, they get a little freaky. I also love that they retconned Iris' backstory, and now she's love journalism from the start. What a great choice.
We can blame Flashpoint for that, though.
Exactly. We can blame Flashpoint, and I'm happy to do so.
Also, that, like, because her mom, because Francine was a journalist, so you could say that maybe baby Iris did, when her mother was still around, was very much pro-journalism, but then when her mother disappeared, she turned pro-police like her dad, so.
Yeah, there you go. You can still say that. And I felt like not only did we get Iris being supported, Iris doing her job, Iris actively saving the day, but it was like the writers really had like a list of West Allen grievances, right? Like, we got Barry and Iris dancing after 5 years, Barry complimenting Iris' appearance after 4 years, Iris talking about Francine at length after 3 years. Like, it was just like really like all the things that we've been like, where the fuck is this? They were like, oh, it's here. Is this what you ordered? Because this is what we brought. I also really liked the mini Iris and Ralph team up. It was a lovely accidental homage to Stanley, who, as we know, passed last weekend. So, you know, they obviously weren't planning it to be that because they just love Spider-Man and they always include him all the time. But it was nice in the moment. It felt, you know, it felt apropos. And I really just, like, obviously we had to talk about Iris diving off the damn roof to save her man. Because, like, first off, it's, like, super reckless and brave, but also, like, super cool and quick thinking. Because it's, like, she has the gumption, haha, to risk possible death to save Harry. But at the same time, she's also got the reasoning to be like, okay, I'm going to jump off this roof, I'm going to unlock his metacuffs, and then he's going to save us from falling. You know? My brain would not have processed it that quickly. I know that much.
A lot of, like, fanboys either that did not understand. They're like, he's not a base jumper. I'm like, what the fuck does base jumping have to do with, like,
people were being ridiculous.
Saying people.
But Curtis has 14 PhDs. They need to explain that.
Her mind is so powerful. And I just want to point out that when she said, I know I'm not a speedster, but my husband, my partner, my best friend is, like, for those of you, and I know that those of you are not actually listening to this podcast, but I hope that you do, so that you can know that when you didn't understand what We're the Flash means, that is what We're the Flash means. That Iris may not have these powers, but the person that is the most important person in her life, that she does everything with, has them. So together, they use them, just like they did in this episode. And finally, I'm so glad that Nora got to see her parents be that in love, to see her mom be that badass, and then finally understand who Iris really is and be prepared to get to know her in the present and to be so happy. Because like, you could see how moved she was by the fact that this Iris was willing to let her in. So she was operating from the misconception that this Iris was like 30 years from now Iris, who is never going to exist now that you've come back in time. So say goodbye to your mom, because you don't know her anymore.
Like, why do you need to be that proactive about changing your mom's perspective? Or yes, you are about changing like your dad's disappearance.
Exactly. All, all of that and more, but I guess I'll also get my non-Iris and West Island stuff out of the way too. Loved Ragdoll. He was a memorable villain, and the way he twisted himself and then the sound effects they added for it made it really creepy and sinister. Sisko getting some much-needed development is something I know we've all wished for, and it finally happened. I love that the subplot shifted back towards him and that he got to express himself and his insecurities. And it was a great scene between him and Caitlin, and I like that he admitted he's a bit lost without the full strength of his powers and wanted to feel useful by helping his friend. And we need more of these moments for him in the future. Cecile telling Nora to respect her mother was a great moment, and then telling Nora stories about how much of an amazing person Iris was and is was really well done. I also love that we got more on the backstory of Iris and Barry's friendship from their elementary school years, even though the show seems to have forgotten that Barry's parents died at 11, but whatever, I'll let that go. It was really heartwarming, and Iris helping Barry because she wanted to make him feel better and smile nicely. Nicely paralleled Barry in the present trying to make Iris feel better and smile. So I thought that was really good. Yeah. Barry's face when Mrs. Merkel basically said they weren't going to give a donation as soon as he introduced himself was comical. as was Ralph saying he wants to try something he saw in the comic book and then went all Spider-Man. That was really cute. Now to my Iris and West Island focus. I love that this episode was so very Iris-driven. She was supported. She was cared for. She got to work through her feelings about Nora, about her past with her mom and whether she's a good mom in the future. She got to be a hero. She got to investigate. Got some romance and some bonding time with Nora. It was just so good that I'm still feeling happy about the episode days later. And I haven't even rewatched it. I like that Iris went into parent mode and got to yell at Nora for not listening and putting people's lives in danger at first. That was a great moment because she just snapped. It didn't matter that Nora was mad, but her behavior was rude. And I'm glad Iris finally got to explode to her, like directly to her face. I like that Barry was basically being husband of the year and trying to comfort Iris in any way possible, from wanting to team up on the case to the pride he showed when he mentioned how happy he was to see her investigating again. And I'm glad he was the one who brought up Francine, because his lack of comfort during 2A is still something I haven't forgotten. So I'm glad he knows her well enough to call attention to it now and make Iris feel better about the kind of mother she could be and is. And I like that it was even brought up and that Iris at different points in the episode got to talk things out and that it didn't happen just once. Like, it wasn't just, oh, well, last episode happened and we're not going to continue with it. It played off of the emotional climax from Newsflash really well, and Iris' feelings and vulnerabilities were treated with such care and thoughtfulness that I was a bit surprised by how good the writing actually was. So more of that, writers. And the romance stuff was just amazing. I loved how giddy Barry was to have a date night with his wife. He acted like he was finally getting to go out with his dream girl, even though he's known Iris for years and they're married. Barry and Iris entered that gala in slow-mo like they own the place, and they did, because they had power couple written all over them. And I love that they were bickering over who would talk to Merkel and what they would say. And Barry getting Iris to dance and putting a smile on her face as he spun her around toward him was nicely done. And then the slow-mo dancing while they gazed at each other so lovingly was just straight out of a romance movie. And the music in the background was gorgeous and really added to the romance of the scene. Like, they just looked really good and their chemistry was so palpable that I almost felt like I was intruding on a private moment. And then finally, Iris jumping off of a building was amazing and unexpected. I haven't been this surprised since the first proposal. And when she ran to the edge, I honestly thought she was just going to look over and that Nora would save him. But the girl flew over that building and straight down. And
she's a guy.
She's right.
Right.
She's like, I'm going to make this look good too. I'll go up this building. Yeah, I was really surprised. Like, it was crazy. It was memorable. And I love the adrenaline fueled I love yous after. And even more importantly, I'm really glad Nora got to see her mom be a hero and happy that she's come to the realization that she clearly doesn't know her mom as well as she thinks she does. And I also like the idea that keeps popping up on the show that the future can be changed. And then the end scene where they bonded and how they kind of start over was really heartwarming and felt so satisfying after 5 episodes of angst and tension. So all the worrying and the writers did a great job with the storyline, so I'm really, really pleased. But now, onto our unhappy thoughts. What are some things we didn't like about this episode?
Well, I mean, luckily, because we had so many likes, there's not much to dislike. But, so, like, basically, short story, whatever I didn't say in the first half, I didn't like this one. But, to be honest, as much as I like the visual effects of Ragdoll and Troy James's, like, performance, everything else about Ragdoll as a villain was pretty shallow and lackluster. Like, he's literally a spoiled rich kid that's mad at his mom, cut him off. So now he's just, like, you know, robbing and causing pain to other people for what? Like, there's not, like, a lot of motivation behind how he chooses his victims. And he seems kind of, like, ridiculous a little bit as a villain. But I don't know. I guess he doesn't really need that much of deep of a backstory. I guess I would have just preferred. I understand how they were relating, like, his relationship with his mom to Iris and Nora for the episode, but I think it would have just been better if he was just, like, evil for this, like, if he really crawled out from the depths of hell to like cause it would have been like a better backstory for him. And then, you know, Nora, of course, like, her blow up at Iris was ugly and unfair, but I can be mad about it, but she got called out multiple times throughout the episode, so, about her attitude, so it's not like, you know, she was being ugly with no repercussions. And I don't even know what happened to Caitlin's plot, other than they were circling the dream until the very end, where they found set up for the next episode. So, I did not like that Cisco was vibing a lot of stuff and, like, stretching his limits, and no one even noticed that it was damaging him, or no one, like, I feel like they kind of asked in the beginning, and he was like, oh, no, it's going to be fine, and then they just took his word that it was going to be fine, and no one really, like, was looking at him and seeing him getting progressively worse until he had a nosebleed, blacked out. And then I also, like, rolled my eyes at Caitlin thinking, like, Sherlock's sketch of, like, a goddess was hers. Oh, it's me! He's like, no, it's a goddess. I'm like, oh my god. Whatever.
You didn't think it bore a striking resemblance to Caitlin?
That she's a goddess? That, like, I feel like, I was with you, Sterling, on this journey, on this icy journey, but now you're pushing it.
for my dislikes, Nora just still acts so childish. It's, like, really strange to me. I get what they're going for, and I understand why she's upset, but I don't know why they have her behaving like she's a teenager. Like, they could have easily just, you know, had her born at a different time, but had her come back from an earlier time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know why I know that, you know, Jessica Parker Kennedy is actually in her 30s, but she could easily play a teen, and they've written Nora as a teen, so there's no reason why they can't make her, you know, either write her like a woman in her mid-20s or play her like a teen. So I don't know, it's weird. But, like, also, like, I know that she's reckless and whatever, she doesn't think things through, but, like, when she set up that crib and she didn't even use any screws, like, how reckless are you? How little do you think things through? I don't know. It was a little bit like, okay, all right, Nora. Anyway, I didn't mind the Caitlin storyline, but I still think that it's more interesting in terms of, like, the potential that's there rather than what's actually being shown. Like, right now, it's just very much like, let's find my dad. And then, you know, when people say they're going to do something and then they did it off screen and they come back and it's already done, and you're like, how did that happen? Why did you do that off screen? I wish that this was one of those times. I wish she would just go find her dad and then come back because it's not that exciting watching, you know. I think because Cisco is actually going through something, like dealing with something serious this episode, the Sherlock and Ralph little rivalry that was going on, which is really the only thing that was happening, the episode, aside from Cisco going through something, was just kind of, like, more grating than normal. Like, the last couple episodes, I was like, oh, that's kind of cute and fun, because there weren't really any stakes. Therefore, I could be like, yeah, I feel that Ralph is, you know, insecure, and Sherlock's ego is bloated. But this time, I was like, can y'all just shut up and let Cisco, you know, like, notice Cisco? Feel things for Cisco? So that's why that bothered me. And I do agree that the backstory for Peter Merkle was a little bit blurry. Like, his mom was, like, bought him things, but, like, wasn't very nice to him, I guess. And then he was mad about that. So he decided to steal stuff from her and got arrested. And then he got, hit with whatever, the shrapnel or whatever it is in the satellite. And now he's in constant pain. So he wants to bring other people pain. Like, that's what I got out of it. That's like, the events. But it was kind of like they weren't all, like, they didn't connect well together. Because at first, when that dude, the rich guy, was giving the woman the necklace, and he said that it was, like, his mom's prized, whatever, family heirloom from his mom. So I was like, okay, it's not moms, right? So then, like, Iris is talking about her daughter. She's a mom. I don't like her either, because I hate moms. But then there's an architect. So the architect was not anything related to mom.
They needed, like, a Gotham name drop.
Yeah, exactly.
They just needed, like, Gotham in there somewhere.
Right. He could have been like, my mother left me this, you know, the legacy of architects or something, and then I would have been like, yeah, mom. See, he really hates moms. But no, it was not, it didn't, there was not really a connection there. He's just like, I like hurting people. Okay. Speaking of, you know, hurting people, it hurts me that the satellites are working again. I can't believe that Cisco's betrayed me this way. Top 10 anime betrayals. When Cisco got the satellite. That's all.
I completely agree about the satellites. Still upsetting, but hopefully they won't actually use them the way that they did in the past, and we'll continue to have people, you know, do the groundwork, so to speak. And I agree that Ragdoll's motivations were sketchy, too. Like, he wasn't stealing things for the sake of stealing them because he wanted to hurt people, but I think kidnapping Barry was the one thing that made most sense. Otherwise, he's just saying he's inflicting pain because rich people just can't stand the thought of being without their material things, and that's kind of lame. He could have patched things up with his mom, too, given that he wasn't exactly innocent either. Like, she said he was trying to break into his own house, which is a strange thing to do. Well, that was strange, too. I also have to finally say it. Caitlin's subplot kind of put me to sleep this week, so I was really bored, and I've stopped caring for any of the mystery surrounding her father. Like Tati said, it's more about the potential, so right now there's just not enough happening, it's too much, like, ridiculousness, I guess, and Ice Goddess, more clues, Tannhauser, safe houses, like, what in the actual hell? We expected that another reboot of her story could potentially mean some development for Caitlin as a person, but it doesn't seem the writers are invested in her so much as they're invested in just introducing a new character that happens to be related to her. Like, we still don't know why she wants Killer Frost back. Not really. It's just really underwhelming. And the scene transitions didn't flow well into the main storyline. And this is being drawn out for too long when it doesn't have to be. And then finally, and this is more like a nitpick, but I hate Sherlock's accent. It comes and goes. Tom needs to figure it out because I put the captions on to not miss anything. But I actually had to read them this episode when he talked. What are our predictions?
You want to bring Amy's her?
Oh yeah,
this is where we would like to read. This is like where we would like to read Cammy's questions. So, in terms of predictions, Tarkamwat on Twitter asked, "What things from the past do you think Barry does not want Nora to see or know about? Will we get a glimpse of how things are in the future in episode 100? Because, in case y'all didn't know, episode 100 is going to be Barry and Nora go to the past to try to solve the cicada crisis, right?
Yeah.
And in the meantime, Sherlock goes to Iris with a theory about Nora, with something strange he's noticed about Nora. And Caitlin uncovers some key person who can help with cicada. So, what do we think? What are some things from the past that Barry would not want Nora to see or know about?
I mean, one of them was probably his mom's death, I'm sure.
Really?
Probably she knows about it, but he probably wouldn't want her to see it. He'd probably send her out. Right. Yeah. With that.
I don't know about anything else from his past that he wouldn't want her to see. Maybe some, like, hard moments for him or...
Yeah. Like, getting bullied.
Yeah. But I'm sure we'll get to see, like, new stuff as well. But I'm not sure what other things he might not want her to see. But the big one is definitely his mom's, like, seeing his mom's death.
Yeah.
He doesn't want her to see Iris kissing Eddie.
No one wants to see that. Maybe he thinks if she sees that, then she'll go off on Iris again or something. I don't know.
I can't believe she loved it for the fiction.
Or maybe she doesn't want him to, like... Maybe he doesn't want her to interact with EOLs.
Mm. Right. He
wants to protect her from EOLs.
Which I surprise, surprise. Exactly.
Surprise, surprise. Sherlock is going to be telling Iris in the present that he thinks that she's working with Eobard. Like, Nora's, like, the person that's helping Nora is probably Eobard. I know a lot of people, I know y'all want it to be Dawn, but Dawn does not exist at this moment. I think that Nora is an only child, clearly. Clearly, she's an only child. Because her attitude, she acts like an only child. But when she goes back, because of all the changes in the timeline, that's when Dawn will show up. She'll go back as a twin. So I think the person that's helping her, it makes, like, Eobard just makes, like, the most sense. Because, like, who else would fuck up Nora's life by snitching... to her that Iris put in a tracker and gassing her up that her mom doesn't understand her and that she needs to go back to the past. Because if you think about it, like, Barry disappears in 2024 fighting Eobard. So he has much of a reason for Nora to save her dad and prevent 2024 as she does wanting her dad to be alive. So I really feel like, and it would be like a good parallel because, you know, Barry's trying to protect Nora from Eobard in the past, not knowing that he's already gotten to Nora in the future. So that's just how I feel like that will play out.
I totally agree with this. And I think that leads into her second question, which is, will we get a glimpse of how things are in the future? And I think that we will, because I think that through Sherlock telling Iris what he knows, Iris maybe, you know, will be able to find something out that will give us a glimpse of what things are like in the future. And maybe, like, even if they don't, like, you know, Iris is not going to travel to the future, but maybe we will actually get a scene that shows us how...
Eobard's in face.
Yeah.
Yeah, seeing Eobard's in face and shows us how Nora decided to travel back.
I wonder if they're going to revisit the points in time that Nora was visiting, because we still don't know why, like, she was going through those specific points.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It'll happen in the back half of the season. Mm-hmm. Like, once, like, the whole shit comes out in the 100th episode that... Eobard is helping Nora in the future, then crossover, then when we get back, then we'll start to explore, like, Nora will start to be like, well, he asked me to do this, and he asked me to do that, and then we'll start to see, like, the reasons why that she was going back and choosing those specific points in time.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think, like, the 7th episode, the Thanksgiving episode, because it's in the description, it said, like, Nora is upset or angry about her dad's disappearance, and I think that's not that she's going to be angry at Iris again, or angry at Barry even, but maybe angry at the situation that she's finally getting to enjoy what her life could have been like with both of her parents, and why can't she change that kind of thing?
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think from my prediction, it was just like Sherlock bringing his concerns, obviously he's going to pick up on something else in the next episode, and then for the 8th episode, he'll bring those... start questioning, like, who sent her, and then put that on Iris's radar.
Right. I agree with that. And then my prediction would just be for the end of the season. I think that when Nora goes home, she's going to have a super open and happy mom. She's going to have way more experience with her powers, because she's never going to have lost them. Her dad will be alive, and she will now have a brother. I'm speaking that into existence. Yep. So, can't wait till that.
She's gaining so much.
Exactly. Messing with time travel does work sometimes.
Oh. Moving into Black Lightning. Jefferson and Anissa work together investigating the hometown of a creepy man at the clinic and make a shocking discovery. Gamby supposedly dies, and everyone mourns his death. Jefferson takes it really hard and is in denial. Meanwhile, with cyanide gone, Tobias puts an increasing amount of pressure on Khalil to help him fill some of the void left in the organization, aka he wants him to become like family to him, and if he disappoints him one more time, he's a dead man. This episode was written by Lamont McGee. What did we like about this episode?
Well, hold on. First of all, I feel like whoever wrote the synopsis didn't actually watch the episode. So I'm like, where was Jefferson in this investigating? You didn't imagine that?
He asked a question, okay? He asked you a question.
Like, he was busy.
So I will say, I loved seeing that Anissa was volunteering, working at that hospital, working towards the good of the community, finally having a job. So I'm really proud of her. And her concern for the pregnant couple was really touching. I liked how they threaded that, like, fiancé guys or whatever he was, husband, I don't know, boyfriend, I don't know what he was, paranoia throughout the scene. So then it, like, you knew it was building to something, right? Like, I didn't know what, like, I was watching it thinking it was, like, Grey's Anatomy, right? Like, oh, we're going to get to the root of this couple's problems. And then suddenly it was like, nope, alien goo is consuming him and he is concerned the same thing will happen to his wife and child. Speaking of the alien goo, I am scared shitless for Grace, but I'm glad that this means that she's going to be involved in the superhero side of the story, right? Because something's going on there, so I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes. I hate that I love Jennifer and Khalil, but I do. I'm feeling it. And they have their scenes. I'm like, oh, And then, it's like, so I'm like, no, stop, Tatiana. But I feel like she, you know, like, it's like she feels the pull towards him, even though she doesn't want to be, right? She pushes him off, but she goes back because she still has whatever feelings for him. At the same time, he obviously seems to really want to be with her, but his ass is trapped in Whale World and, you know, just all around he's just being a shitty dude. So things have got to change before that could go anywhere, if it ever can go anywhere. But right now I kind of like the little, it's not even Romeo and Juliet, but it's just like something.
There is something there that we cannot identify quite yet.
That undefinable thing that it is doing well. All right. Henderson was, like, really great about, you know, Gamby's death, and he was really understanding. He's gonna make a great fill-in uncle now that Gamby's gone. And I think that everyone's reactions to the news about Gamby were really well done. Like, Anissa breaking the news to Jennifer, for example, like, was, like, really sweet and bittersweet, really, but it really gave you, once again, another glimpse of just, like, how realistic they are as sisters. And Anissa, you see her being strong for her father and for her sister, but she's also, you know, just as much as they are, she's affected by it. But she has to stay strong, keep moving, you know, try to make the next thing happen. So I like that juxtaposition where it's like everything stops for Jefferson. He doesn't really know where to go from here. And Anissa is like bulldozing ahead. And then, of course, Crest's performance as Jefferson was really beautiful, was really heartbreaking. Gamby was like a father to him. So we really saw Jefferson going through, you know, that pain and that heartache all episode. And he acted out, right? He had his moments of, like, freaking out towards Lynn at the bar. But it all made sense. It was really understandable. And then when he finally broke down, looking at the watch, the pocket watch in Gamby's office or lab or whatever you want to call it, like, I was tearing up too. And I really, you know, I just really felt like I felt his pain. Also, I just love Two Bits. So, Two-Bit, every time that they see him, I'm like, yeah, Two-Bit. So, yay, come back again soon. Also, I love Lynn, and even though I did not love her storyline this episode, I like that it's always her, like, her goal is always to do the best for the most people. Yeah. So, I like that she does not veer from that goal. And I'm going to assume that Anissa's I Can't Wait to See You Either was to Grace, and that they work things out and are going to give it a real try. So, I'm really happy about that. Because I'm assuming that, and then I like that, you know, I just like that we see how much she wants to help people, right? So, as soon as the alien goo thing happens, she's, like, on her way to find the pregnant lady, right? And no random, creepy, gooey police officers are gonna stop her, damn it. And also that Henderson was helping, because I really like Henderson's involvement, even though this increased activity is coming at the cost of Gamby. I love Henderson, so yay. Yeah. There we go.
I love your Thunder Grace optimism.
I know. I was going to say, like, at least one of us is optimistic. One of us has to be.
The Thunder Grace advocate. Okay.
No.
How dare you?
You better be, because, like, listen, the way that Crest acted his ass off through Jefferson's, like, five stages of grief in this episode, they outsold, and it would just be, like, so fake if we went through all of that, and then Gandy's like, surprise, bitch, like, like, you better be dead for real if we're getting all of this emotional content. Yeah, so Jefferson was just, like, great in this episode, and, like, watching him go through all, he basically went through most of the five stages. I was shocked at how harshly he lashed out at Link. She was trying to do, like, a nice gesture for him, but it did make sense in the context of his grief and seeing him go through, you know, first being in denial and then being angry, because I suppose, like, he thought if we don't move or touch anything, then it would just be like, you know, it's on pause, and then Gamby's going to come back any second, and then we can resume to our regular program schedule. But then Lynn, like, giving him the pocket watch kind of, like, broke the illusion that, you know, he and everybody else could just assume that Gamby survived and just, like, live in that little happy space. So it makes sense why he was angry. And then later, when he hits, like, the depression stage at Gamby's shop and just, like, breaks down into tears, that, you know, it's been a full day or so and Gamby still hasn't made any contact. Where is he, kind of thing? It was just really powerful. And the fact that Anissa could be there for him in that moment. And you could tell Nafessa really felt it too. Like, her lip was, like, trembling and everything. So, like, that's how you know, like, there's some acting going on in that scene. And speaking of Anissa, I like how, like, because they always contrast Anissa and Jefferson and the way that they react to things. And that includes, like, the way that they cope with the grief. Because Anissa jumps straight to acceptance. Henderson, like, he's dead. She's like, okay, he is dead. So now what do we do? And she's, like, proactive and trying to, like, you know, be the backbone and the support for her dad and for Jennifer. Because Jennifer also broke down. So I like that she wanted to be strong for them, and she wanted to be proactive in doing things and continuing to move, because probably if she stopped moving, then she would feel all the feelings, and so she's trying not to do that. So she's like an action kind of person. No time like the present. Like, she was talking about volunteering at the clinic, and in that conversation, you know, she was like, you know, I wanted to get involved, and there's no time like the present, and that's kind of how she, it seems like how she deals with a lot of things, just in the present moment. The other outlet she used for her grief was Grace, and I did not like that, so that was in my dislikes. But I did like that she hyper-focused on the pregnant couple and the mystery goo and jumping into that, because that's what Gamby would have wanted her to do. The thing that I did like about the Thunder Grace scene was all Grace all the time. I loved that she made clear boundaries with Anissa on what she expects out of this relationship, because clearly there was no boundaries or expectations, and they hadn't really talked about it before. So I like that Grace was like, you're not going to use me like a handbag whenever you feel like it. Love that. And I agree with you, Tati, that I'm in this, like, weird space where I, like, just turn to people and I don't know what to do about it.
It feels so wrong, but it feels so right.
Yeah, like, writers are working, like, really, really hard to retcon that relationship back into existence. And I feel like the more Tobias keeps abusing Talil, the more sympathy I feel towards him. So on the one hand, I feel like it's tiring that he keeps, like, texting her and messaging her when she clearly does not want to engage with you, Khalil. But on the other hand, I also thought it was really sweet that he, first of all, when they met up in school, he apologized in his role in uprooting her life, even though he doesn't know that it's also because she has powers, but he recognizes that him disrupting the school, and that played, like, a major part in why she's not allowed to go back to her normal life anymore, and that he destroyed their relationship. So I'm going to assume that his apology was also for that, too. And then secondly, that he wanted to check on her to make sure she was okay after hearing about Gamby dying. Because I feel like he was there completely for her in that moment. And it's kind of even really more sad to me, because he should have someone there for him, because he is getting abused by Tobias, and he's kind of holding all that in, but he still wants to be, like, 100% supportive to Jennifer, and so I was like, ah!
No!
And, like, no one knows that he's suffering with Tobias, and Tobias is just gonna, like, kill him, probably.
No! Tobias is not gonna kill him!
And, like, he could just, like, disappear any minute, and no one would have known.
Don't speak that into existence. He's supposed to get redeemed, right? Not die.
Someone call Child Protective Services, please. I'm worried about him now.
Well, I really love Jefferson this entire episode. Like, you could really feel his pain throughout, and the way that he dealt with Gamby's death. Like, he wanted to see evidence of his body and then came to the conclusion that he was really gone and grieved. It was hard to watch that pain, but it was so well played by Cress Williams, and I thought his performance was really moving. And I also like that Anissa was doing something great and chose to work at the clinic. It puts her at the center of her community and also reminds us that she's studying medicine, so her being there makes sense and really worked out well. And I like that even though Jennifer went to see Khalil, she didn't just jump back into his arms, even though it seems that you guys want her to. Like, she's still on the fence about her feelings for him and her next steps, and I like that it wasn't just a quick fix. So I think there's going to be a turning point when she finally decides what she's going to do fairly soon. And I like that we're finally getting to see Grace develop her powers in some way, and that she'll be tied into the story somehow beyond being only linked to Anissa. And I'm glad we got some of her backstory and why she's particularly salty that Anissa can't seem to commit, because she has her own, like, trust issues from her past. And I'm glad that she finally got to, like, express those feelings to her. And I like that there's a new mystery that involves South Freeland. Like, I'm so intrigued. I didn't know South Freeland existed, but I'm interested to see where it's going. And I like that Anissa was smart, and instead of continuing to drive there, she hightailed it back to North Freeland after seeing some freaky shit, because I would have done the same thing. And finally, I love the scene of Anissa breaking the news to Jennifer about Gamby's death, and then later comforting her father. I think she was the glue that kind of held them all together this episode, even though she was clearly affected by Gamby's death as well. So what do we not like about this episode?
I don't like that they're going to let White Grandpa Gamby go out like that. I do not buy it. I cannot imagine that he's actually dead. So, yeah, I mean, unless it's, like, the actor was just like, I don't really feel like doing this anymore. And they're like, okay, fine, we'll write you out. Like, I don't know. It just seems, like, really anticlimactic. I don't really know what's going on with Call Me Parker and Tobias Whale. Like, I feel like Tobias was, like, so great in season one, and now it's, like, they killed everyone around him off, so he's just, like, not very interesting, especially because it's, like, yeah, Khalil's still there, but the way he treats Khalil, like, I want Khalil out of there, right? I want a free Khalil, so it doesn't make Tobias more interesting. And when he had people like Joey whatever the fuck and Cyanide, it's at least, like, people that are loyal to him and of course, Tori, right? Like, people that he's treating well. That it makes you not root for him, but it makes you see him as a character and not just an obstacle. And so now he's, like, become an obstacle because there's no one left, you know, there's no one left that makes him any kind of rootable. It's like Kingpin and Vanessa, right? Like, Vanessa's still around here, you know, in season three, because we need something that roots Kingpin to a point of humanity, basically. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, whatever. Right now, Tobias is lacking that, and it makes me not care about his scenes. Okay. And while I have high hopes for Thunder, I had high hopes for Thunder Grace, and I still think it can be rectified, I do agree with, like, what is going on right now, right? Something just, like, feels off. It's off that Anissa, it seems like she's using Grace, because we don't see her think about Grace unless Grace is right there in front of her, you know? But there was that one time that Jennifer was like, you need soul food. But it's not like Jennifer knows who Grace is. So she wasn't talking about that, you know? It's and since we only see Grace when she's around Anissa, so, like, all we know about Grace is that she loves Anissa, it feels really imbalanced. So I don't want to sound like I'm just ragging on Thunder Grace, because, like we've said, Black Lightning has this issue across ships. So to point to one that I think that they're doing, like, this is the one they're currently doing best, is Jennifer and Khalil, it's still an issue because the continuity doesn't flow. It is a retcon, since they chose to make him a jerk to Jennifer first. and then have him meet up with Khalil. There was no meet up with Tobias, and there was no reason to do that. They should have had Tobias get to him, and then him push Jennifer away because of the life that he was getting involved with Tobias. That would have made the most sense. And now he obviously would regret that. He loves Jennifer, etc. So he wants to try to make things better. But instead, it was like, well, why were you a jerk that time? You know? Like, I feel like you didn't really like her that much because you were an asshole when you had no, when she was right there for you when you were, you know, she was supporting you and you were just a huge jerk. So anyway, what I'm saying is that, like, it's not just Thunder Grace. But they need to work as hard on Thunder Grace as they have been on Jennifer and Camille. And more so, because I'm pretty sure more people are interested in Thunder Grace than in Jennifer and Khalil. I don't know. I'm not sure, but it may just be us who are interested in Jennifer and Khalil. Anyway. I don't like that half the Greenlight kids died. Like, I feel like it's just, like, a bunch of losses. I don't think we need this many losses.
Like, what's the point of having this many Greenlight kids if you're going to kill half of them anyway? And we don't even see what they do.
Yeah, exactly. We still don't know what the point is of the Greenlight kids at all. It's just that they are, you know, she wanted to save them. She only got to save half of them. And yeah, like, I hate Dr. Jace, but obviously this is what she was going to do. She's a sociopath, right? Like, she just wants to get the results that she wants. She doesn't care about people at all. So what I like less than, you know, hating Dr. Jace is that I don't like that, like, Lynn didn't even check for herself first. Like, they just had her be like, yeah, I'm going to trust the crazy doctor who's like, yes, this will work. Even though just 2 seats ago, she was like, I literally do not care about anyone's lives. I just want us to finish this experiment. But whatever. I know it's like, I'm not blaming Lynn. It's not her fault. It's the writing for her in this episode. But it's just like, why would she do that? I don't believe that.
Yeah.
And then, there we go.
Is that Oprah gift? Like, well, there you go.
What did you think was going to happen?
That's what happened. Like, and you can see it from a mile away. And Lynn still fell into it. She's like, well, yeah. For me, it's like, even from the beginning, so this is going back to the premiere episode, I'm like, what is this The Walking Dead? Like, we just randomly kill off main characters with no pretense whatsoever. Like, did they really just kill off Gambi? It's the same kind of, like, wait, what the fuck that I had when Fally, of all people, killed Cyanide. I'm like, is she dead? Like, for real? Like, did you really just kill Gambi in, like, a Sunday afternoon hit and run? Like, what is this? Like, it's so odd to me. And it's, like, two things that Black Lightning does the weakest, or if you want to look at it in a different way, the most unconventional. You don't want to call it weak. It's very unconventional the way that they write ships and the way that they kill off characters. Like, at least in The Walking Dead, they developed a pattern of spending the episode spotlighting the character before they killed them off. So you could, like, see, like, oh, you're about to die. But with, you know, Cyanide's death, while annoyingly abrupt, she was not a main character. She didn't really speak at all. She was just there to kind of, like, be Tobias' sidekick. So the audience could kind of easily get over it because she's not really super important to the main character or the plot or anyone else other than Tobias. But with Gambi has been a major family character, an important role in Jefferson's life since before the pilot. It just feels like the way that he dies, there's no buildup to it, there's no warning, and I guess you could call it realistic because people die all the time without any kind of rhyme or reason, but since this is a show, and we are so invested in Gambi, and it didn't really feel like Gambi's story was complete or done. Because we don't know, doesn't seem like there's any point right now, because we don't really know who did it. You know, Tubit says that it was the government, you know, that's just like kind of a vague rumor. It could have been Tobias, but I mean, when has Tobias ever successfully put out something that harmed Gambi? I guess today. I don't know, but there's no kind of really reason, like, why it happened now, the way that it happened, or why Gambi's, like, Batman paranoia ass didn't see it coming, didn't see people following him, didn't, you know, notice until it was too late. Like, his SUV structural integrity was, like, one hit and it was already at 37%. Like, what the fuck? Did you not charge your van's armor or something? Like, what? But the Black Lives Matter really just, I guess they just really want to kill off all the white people, huh? Like, you know, everyone, if you're white, you are not long for this show. I mean, I was of Jefferson. Like, this man has, the Gambia has contingency plans on top of contingency plans. Like, I am in denial. I want to see the body, no death. I want to see the receipts. Where is it? Because I felt like I was waiting most of the episode for the other shooter drop and for him to show up around the corner, and it just never came. So now I feel like I've, like, slowly moved in to, in my stages of grief over this, I'm slowly moving into the anger stage. Like, if he really is dead, then I'm mad at Gandy for letting his old ass get jumped. Like that. Like, he wasn't even investigating or doing anything shady, and that's why he got, you know, killed. You know, he was just, like, speaking Japanese with the fruit vendor guy, buying fruit.
They were jealous that his Japanese was too good, like you said.
I guess so. But it pissed me off. And then going back to the other thing that Black Lightning doesn't do well, I was not expecting, after the lead up, the whole kind of mess with the other girl, and then, you know, Anissa going to Grace and being like, I want to try, and then the full episode of nothing, no trying happening, for it to be reintroduced because Anissa wanted condolence sex from Grace. Like, that's not what I was looking for. And it was, I feel like it wasn't what Grace was looking for either, apparently. Like, you know, how are you going to use your, like, you come to someone that you say that you like, you've been ghosting her for I don't know how long, you say you want to give it a try, and the first time that we see you come together is because your uncle died, and you want Grace to do something about that? Like, did you not see how that would come off? Like, I mean, I feel like it would be one thing if she and Grace were more consistently dating or in a relationship, but we don't really see any of that, and it, so it does, like, I do feel like Grace feels that it's just like, you're just using me for sex, or whenever you feel like I'll be there, just because I don't have anything better to do other than wait for you. So I don't understand. I know people were excited that they finally hooked up, but I didn't even like the story around the hookup, so I couldn't really root for them having a moment.
Right.
Was it? Because, you know, like, I don't even know if they talked together before Anissa, again, like, after their initial conversation to try, they even talk before Anissa just, like, shows up at her door. Tassi thinks that she was flirting on the phone with Grace. The episode.
Well, she'd be like her mom. Yeah, I'll be right there, mom. Like,
maybe she's going back to, like, Zoe or whoever the songwriter or whatever. Because she's like, you know, I'm tired of this emotional shit. Because you see, like, the scene, they didn't end on good terms. Because Grace is like, stay away from me. So, like, did they make up or did Anissa just decide to, like, bounce again? And if she did, like, why do Grace and I care more about Thunder Grace than Anissa cares about Thunder Grace? Like, this isn't, like, what I feel like an OTP should be like.
Yeah.
And then, lastly, you know, I mentioned this already, but Tobias just keep abusing Khalil. It's just unsettling. It's too much. And I feel like they keep circling the drain with Tobias and this whole abusing Khalil thing because they have no other really real story for Tobias. His arc moved like a millimeter tonight with Kwame Parker, but he's just like, yeah, I think he's just less interesting now, which is a shame.
Yeah. I mean, I went through the five stages of grief, much like Jefferson did. First, there was denial, then anger, and I'm not sure I'm at acceptance yet. Like, I can't remember what the other two stages were, but I can say that I'll be super annoyed if they don't bring Gambi back. Like, no body, no real death, right? Like, Jess, I was expecting him to pop up by the end of the episode and then have the whole thing be a fake out, but if they're honestly going with Gambi being dead, then I'll be mad at the way they wrote him off of the show. Like, I think he served as good insight into Jefferson's past, and given that he and Jefferson were still not fully healed from the reveal last season, it would be really fucked up if they just left it so unresolved like that and have Gambi go out in a very underwhelming way. Like, he's not a minor character, like you both said, and this is permanent, then the show needs to revamp the way they look at major characters and how they send them off, because this is not the way to do it. And I still don't like the way that they're progressing Thunder Grace either. Whenever we get some progress, Grace disappears and only reappears when Anissa feels like going to see her or accidentally bumping into her. Like, I need some more consistency. Anissa needs to either become more invested from week to week or just give up on being with Grace at all, because it shouldn't be about guilt. It shouldn't be because she's feeling sad about Gambi. And as of right now, there's clearly no investment on Anissa's part, and that makes me not be invested. So she should either want to give it a shot or at least be shown trying, because the ship is sinking and it like needs to find some way to stay afloat. And finally, I dislike Dr. Jace. I know that Lynn should have checked, but I hate her. she's a psycho, and I hope that I don't have to see her anymore. Predictions. What do we think is going to happen with the South Greenland.
I wonder if they were focused on like another or different ASA experiment. Like North Greenland had the green light, so South Greenland has like alien goo. And I don't know, the way that they introduced Anissa's powers, or not Anissa, Grace's powers, are they trying to say that she's from South Greenland and she has like a similar condition? Or, you know, like, I don't know, because seeing how they decided to show that part of Grace's side and the same time that they introduced this new mystery thing in South Greenland, I wonder if those are connected or not.
That's a good prediction. I definitely think that they are connected. And my only prediction is that, you know, Grace being affected by this situation is what's going to not only rope her into Thunder storyline, like learn about Nissa's, you know, double life, but also bring about the start of the Outsiders. So that's all I got.
I like those predictions. And I approve. I got nothing. I've been sucking at predictions.
We should never...
Predictions later.
That's all right. It's hard.
All right, moving into Titans. Before Dick can reunite with the Titans, he reluctantly teams up with Jason Todd, the new Robin, to catch a serial killer targeting performers from Dick's surrogate circus family from when he was a member of the Flying Graysons. But Jason's perspective on Bruce Wayne forces Dick to re-examine the truth behind their falling out. And that's what you missed on Titans. basically, Jason is a new Robin. He is a fanboy of Dick. He wants to hang out with him. And they both have been raised by Bruce in very, very different ways. And that is really what the whole episode kind of was about. So what do we like about this episode?
All right. Well, my likes were that Curran Waters did a great job playing Jason. And I thought that it was an abrupt transition from, you know, like his like sort of like, oh, this is so fun, to like, I'm a murder you personality. But it felt natural because of his performance. So he did really well on both. They all felt like extreme sides of the same Jason. I also thought it was a good exploration of Dick's insecurities and his fears. Like, it was, I think, the best work that the show has done in terms of fleshing him out all season. You know, he had a father figure and a home that he could have grown up in that wasn't Bruce, that we finally met and that we learned about. So he feels some bitterness about the path, you know, the path that was left untaken. But at the same time, he's jealous of Jason's new bond with Bruce, and he doesn't like the thought of being replaced, because, like, Bruce is his daddy, right? Or at least was for several years. Mm-hmm. And he gets both the confirmation that Bruce creates monsters because Jason's a monster, but at the same time, it's also like, no, I was mom, you know, even without Bruce, I was doing this and I'm still doing this, you know, like, uh-huh. So like, it still left the question of like, who are you really, Dick, right? Which I like that Jason asked that and then Dick couldn't answer it. Uh-huh. But I finally care about the answer. So that's definitely progress. Also, I really love Clayton. He's just a nice, naive guy. He really thought he was doing right by Dick. And I thought it was super cute that he didn't figure out that Bruce was Batman. He was like, what does Bruce think about you working with Batman? But I thought it was really sweet how Dick just, like, wanted to let him think. Like, yeah, no, I'm happy. You know, like, oh, yeah, Bruce did a great job. Like, you made the right choice when you sent me off to live with Bruce. Just because, you know, that's the most generous I've ever seen Dick be, outside of, like, oh, I really hope Raven doesn't die, and I guess I will ensure she lives. So, yes. Finally,
Corey,
I love that Corey changed. Thank God. Yeah. I'm glad that she brought the kids to visit Dick. That was fun. And that Gar was, you know, like, can I be a Robin? I see that there's several Robins. I would like to audition. So they were all very cute little interludes in what was otherwise kind of a, you know, like, an episode all about Dick. A Dick fest. So yeah.
Yeah, I really loved, you know, Dick and Clayton's relationship and seeing that and seeing how, you know, it was just like a really, really nice moment from Dick's childhood and then having how that connected to the present. Jason has issues, but I kind of like his little psychotic ass. Tati's right about the great transition of his personality from one extreme to the other, because he starts out like really enthusiastic and happy to be here, and it makes Dick in comparison look ungrateful a little bit for squandering the best gig in the world as Batman's sidekick, because Jason's just like so excited about everything Bruce, and Bruce is like the coolest person in the world and why did you give this up kind of thing. But then like the change is it starts out really subtle, because first it's like, you know, Jason is like what, 15, 16, and they get to the safe house, he's like, hey, you want a beer? And like, and Dick is like, what do you mean you want a beer? Like, you're not supposed to be drinking. So he's like drinking beer from the fridge. You find out like the shit passed with his parents and his alcoholic uncle, his issues with the police, the fact that Bruce found him because he was trying to boost the Batmobile. Even like sneaking into the bar, picking a fight for no goddamn reason in the bar that he's underage at, that he snuck into. And then him, like, literally beating up cops just for the hell of it. And that was really confusing to me, because I was like, what is going on here? Like, I thought we wanted the cops to find the bad guy. Like, why are we fighting the cops? Are they dirty cops? Like, what's going on? And it's like, oh, you were serious when you said fuck the police. Like, okay. Like, he's so different from Dick, which is great. Yeah. Because, like, I know a lot of us were upset when the trailers came out, because we thought that they were, you know, Dick was too dark, they were trying to make him Jason Todd, but, like, clearly, we were mistaken. And then, like, speaking of Dick, again, seeing him in comparison to Jason, I like that, like Tati said, like, it does feel like this is the first time that he's really getting fleshed out, and, like, I really feel like I understand what is the crux of his issue with Bruce more. Because it feels like Bruce tried to raise Dick as if they process tragedy in the same way, but Dick is not Bruce. He's just kind of, like, he can't compartmentalize like Bruce can. And he's just, like, really super soft at heart, and him seeing how dark he is becoming upset him, and he projects all of that responsibility for his darkness onto Bruce. But in spite of how complicated their relationship is, you can tell that Dick still misses being Robin, because, you know, we've been talking about it, we've been, like, making fun of him, like, why do you still have the suit? Why do you still have all this stuff that Bruce gave you if you hate Bruce so much? And it's not that he just, like, there's still, like, a love there that you can see, and you can see, like, in how jealous he was of how quickly Bruce replaced him with Jason and then locked him out of his life, but that is something that bothered him. So he's not, like, I cut Bruce off and, you know, I'm fine. There's still something there. Like I said earlier, I loved learning about Dick's relationship with Clayton and how that was a different father figure in his life and how he still, like, cherishes that relationship. And thank God Clayton did not die, because I was so worried. Like, when we first see him at the funeral, I'm like, who is this black man? And
yeah, he's about to die.
Like, I know he's going to be important. And then when Jason brought him the files, like, please don't let him be the black man that died. But he's the only one that's left alive, and so it's, like, more about saving him. So it's like, yes, you get to stay! And then lastly, all things Dick Corey, of course, like, Dick bringing the family to meet his other family was great. Like, everyone's, like, asking a million questions, and Dick, like, no one's listening to Dick at all. And then Corey, like, lays down the law, like, you sit down, you come with me. Great stuff. Like, and the fact that when he tells her about the situation, like, she's like, do you want me to come with you? It's like she's constantly asking him to team up, because she knows that there's something that's going on with him and she wants to support him. And every time he's like, I can't read something, like, I don't know. Like, this is your chance, Dick. Take the chance. And he's always like, I don't know.
You don't want to take that chance.
But I love that even though that they were apart, that he had these, like, daily check-ins. Like, you know, it's kind of like Corey's like, her husband went away on a business trip, but he calls every night to check on the kids and the prisoner that they have tied in their bathroom. So, like, relationship
built. I love that. Yeah, for me, like, Jason is such an asshole, but, like, he's a fun asshole. I think he provides the episode with great energy, and he has such a different perspective with regards to being Robin. And when he becomes violent, he doesn't have the same remorse the way Dick does. So it's nice. I guess it's nice that we got to see such a different side, and that hanging out with Jason has provided Dick with more clarity because he came face to face with what he was afraid of becoming all along. And I like that we got to delve more into Dick's background and how, as much as he bitches about Batman, or at least sounds like he constantly bitches about Batman, it's his need for revenge that drove him to do things he isn't exactly proud of. And I also like the vibe we got between Dick and Jason and how their personalities clashed, even though Dick was clearly super jealous and annoyed about how quickly Bruce replaced him, which, you know, me too. Finally, I love Dick touching base with Corey as well and drawing her into the next room so they could talk away from the kids. they're really acting like such parents. And I like how Corey was so happy that he seems to finally be opening up more and more. And we finally got a new Corey outfit. Hallelujah. She still has a coat, but the outfit she's rocking. What do we not like?
What did we not like? Okay, well, I didn't like the heel face turn with Jason, like the fight that reveals everything, because I couldn't see it happening physically because it was so dark that at first I was like, what is happening? Who is beating up the police officers? I thought that Dick was doing it for a second. I was like, yeah, what is going on? and then it was like, oh, it was Jason. And then I was like, okay, that makes sense. But then also, like, what the fuck was Dick doing that he didn't notice this happening? Like, is Jason that quiet when he beats up police officers? Whatever. That was strange. And then, you know, once I see this, like, because I like Jessica said earlier, like, I like the subtle, like, you see, like, oh, okay, and he's, you know, the alcohol, and then, like, he's getting that fight in the bar. It's like, okay, so Jason is actually, like, he's got problems, right? But then this was, like, an extreme. It's, like, extreme problems. And then I'm just, like, sitting here wondering, like,
extreme.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it's like, how could Batman not know this is happening, right? Like, and if he does know, why would he let it continue? And now that Dick knows, why isn't he contacting Alfred to be like, hey, listen, you've got a problem with this child in your charge, you know? So, like, I don't, and then I guess finally it's like, either, you know, like, there's like the shared darkness between these two boys that Bruce raised, right? So either he brought that out in them, he enhanced it, or he's not able to stem the tide for them, right? He's not able to hold... to keep them away from it, if that's what he's trying to do. So, like, either way, maybe he shouldn't be raising children. I don't know. But, like, but the series does not seem interested in, like, asking, like, or answering these questions. So instead I'm just like, but how did this just happen? And then now Dick is just going to move on. Like, Dick is just going to be like, this is not my mess to clean up. I will just go now. So, I don't know. I'm sorry, I didn't like that. And then it just reminds me, like, that they could go so much further with it if Bruce could be a character, right? And that it would benefit Dick. But, oh well. Also, just, like, in terms of, like, you know, people saying, like, oh, well, there's, like, they get to be more violent because this is, you know, a streaming service and whatever, right? Like, but there has to be a purpose for it. So, for example, like, why did Dick's entire circus family need to be killed? What was necessary to show, like, all those photos? You think that one photo of one person probably would have been enough? It would then, like, be like, Clayton is next. You know? Okay, I gotta go save Clayton. Because they didn't even give him even, like, a second to, like, process these people that supposedly were his friends or family dying. Mm-hmm. Right? He didn't, like, so instead he just seemed like he just didn't really care.
He cared about one, Tati.
Exactly. He only cared about Clayton. He's like, oh, thank God he's not dead. Thank God he's still around. It was just kind of weird. So it just seemed unnecessary. And also unnecessary were those super long flashbacks that told me nothing new about Dick, other than sometimes Dick is a huge asshole and beats people up unnecessarily. And then sometimes people overhear that and they're like, that was my dad that you did that to. I'm a good question on everyone who you love. So I don't know. We could have spent some of that flashback time on Corey trying to get info out of non-boss guy whose name I have forgotten. That way there would be more of an impact when he's like, I'm only going to talk to Rachel, you know? Instead of just like the one scene, like, hey, what's up? Talk to me. No, I'll only talk to Rachel. Oh, okay. That'll be next week then. So, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was weird that Dick was like, wait till I get back to talk to him. And she's like, okay. And she goes immediately to talk to the guy. I agree with you about, like, if Bruce was a character, like, some of this stuff would make more sense in that we would have a follow-up. So, like, Dick sees Jason beating up on police, and he's like, and he knows that Bruce would not be okay with that. it would have made sense, like, then for there to be, like, a Bruce Dick confrontation for, like, Dick to reach out to Bruce and, like, what the fuck are you doing? Control your new Robin. Right. His replacement is so bad. But we're not going to get that because they don't want to invest in Bruce. But, like, speaking of Bruce, like, Bruce is petty as fuck. And is affecting his moral judgment. Like, there's no way, like you said, like, there's no way that he couldn't have seen, like, all of these major red flags of Jason. Like, Dick only spent, like, a couple days with him and saw all of them, like, immediately. Like, how did Bruce not see this? Like, he was just, like, that petty and that upset that Dick left that he just, like, picked up the first kid trying to steal his car and was like, you're the one. I'm going to use you to make Dick jealous kind of thing. Like, what normal kid is excited to get shot at for and thinks that that's what Batman wants him to do? We wear the red, yellow, and green so we can attract the fire. Like, who would come up with that kind of perspective?
Right.
That this is the job that I want to do. Bruce, like, microchipping Dick, like he's a pet and not a person, was, like, bad form. That's not great. That's not cool, Bruce. Locking Dick out of all the safe houses and changing the passwords is just, like, super petty and ridiculous. Like, Dick was your son, pretty much. Like, I feel like he sent Jason to help Dick specifically for the purpose, not only because they didn't want Bruce to go, the writers didn't want Bruce to go, but Bruce wanted Jason to go because he wanted Dick to see how much better his life was without him. Like, I'm still doing fine. I still have a Robin. And, like, I feel like that was really shitty. And it also backfired because now Dick definitely doesn't want to be Robin, and you're stuck with a psychopath that hates police. So good job.
Like, just Bruce is a failure.
Yeah, like, both of you just say that you're hurt and you miss each other already. Like, damn. Like, this kind of, like, back and forth, just, like, hug it out, something. And then I agree with you, like, the whole flashback sequence of Dick and Zuko was just so long, and I was really confused. Because it was so long, I was so confused about whether it was still a flashback or whether we were in the present day. Like, I don't know where we are in the timeline anymore. And then, like, lastly, like, we mentioned earlier, Titan continues to not know what lighting is and how to light fight scenes because I could barely see shit when did, like, the whole Zuko transport scene where he, like, hijacked the car. Could not see shit.
You right?
Yep. And I think it's weird that they're portraying, or they're trying to portray Batman as this uncaring father figure for Dick, but a reckless father figure for Jason. Like, clearly he doesn't check for Jason, but he seems to overcheck for Dick, if that makes sense. I also didn't like that they killed the rest of the members of the Haley Circus just because. Like, mm-hmm. Like you said, Tati, I guess we're expected to believe that it took 4+ murders for Bruce to realize a connection and want to find Dick, but I think it's questionable because he's supposed to be the world's greatest detective. Like, why didn't you pick up on it earlier? And I still continue to dislike that Dick is so broody. He needs to show a bit more emotion because I didn't really feel it in this episode, even when the whole thing was focused on him. And they really need to acknowledge the ways in which Bruce raised Dick because they're playing it kind of shady right now. And this is from someone who generally likes their relationship in the comics. And I think they're really fucking it up here for drama's sake, even when the other half of this father-son relationship is never even on screen. So I think that they can do it better and try to have, you know, Dick hash out what his issues really are, for even, like, Bruce to be like, I maybe took Jason in because I was being reckless because you just left, so I needed someone.
That's exactly
what it is. Yeah. And then finally,
oh, well.
I didn't like that the rest of the team...
The rebound child.
Yeah, basically. Poor Jason. I didn't really like that the rest of the team barely got anything to do. Like, we barely saw Raven and Gar, and I would have at least liked to have seen them discuss, is it Anderson? And maybe go back... What was it?
Adamson.
And maybe go back and forth on theories or something instead of just waiting around for Dick to come back, because I thought that was just kind of a waste of their time. What are your predictions, ladies?
Let's see. I predict that I saw the promo, and the promo shows Rachel's mom is still alive, or they're saying that she's alive, and the Titans seem like they're going to run straight to a trap to rescue her. So I think that Rachel will turn herself over to her dad, Trigon, whatever the hell his name is, in order to save her mom and or her friends, and then you know, she'll have to defeat him from within while the rest of the team attacks from the outside in the big showdown in the finale.
That's a fair prediction.
There's how many episodes?
There's 11 overall.
11. Mm-hmm. And we, like, Jason is episode 6, right?
Yep.
Yes.
6.
Okay. Because I was like, is it too early for her to give herself over to her dad, or would they, like, say that for episode 8 or whatever? But I guess, yeah. Either way, I don't have anything new to add. I feel like it's... It may not even... I don't know, because I feel like the whole thing with the plot, they keep taking these, like, side stories. Like, this whole one with, like, Dick and Jason, that's kind of hard to predict where the plot is going, because they keep, like, sidetracking from the actual plot. So, we do know that Donna's coming, Donna Troy. Mm-hmm. I think she's coming next episode, too. I think she's in episode 7. I think it's called 7 or 8. One of the episodes is called Donna, so I predict we'll see her soon.
I mean, I want to predict that we'll somehow get more information about Corey's background or lack of memories.
Yeah.
Because we haven't done that since, like, this third episode. Or this, even the first one had, like, the most of her not remembering. So I'd like to see them give us more of that.
That would be nice if we actually came back to that.
Yeah. Side B, Lady with Gumption, nominee... Winner.
Yeah. Well, who's the runner-up? Who's the runner-up for side B?
I don't really know that there is.
Heights didn't really have a lady. There wasn't much gumption.
Mm-mm.
There wasn't much ladies.
There wasn't much ladies.
I think maybe Anissa, you know.
Yeah.
Going out of her way to help that couple. And then power in
Grace
the room.
Grace having gumption for like standing her ground and what she wants out of a relationship.
Yeah, Grace has some gumption there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's very true.
All right, so that they can be our runner ups. And now on to our winner.
And the winner,
Iris won.
Iris won. Why did Iris win, you guys?
Because she had all the feels, and like you said earlier, when we were talking about the feedback, the fact that this episode was something that you got to see her perspective, that she drove every decision that was made throughout the episode, that she was shown to be strong, and other characters valued her strength and being strong, that she came up with a plan to, you know, rescue her husband, that she dove off a roof for him.
A plan. She dove off the roof with a plan.
With a plan and without powers, not knowing what would happen, but it was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love her.
It was like a reverse damsel situation where Barry was actually the damsel and Iris saved him. So, yeah. All of that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Basically.
I agree.
So, obviously, Iris West Allen is our Lady with Gumption of the Week winner. I think this is her second one in a row.
Yeah, it is. So... Sorry to break the chain of, like, different shows. Like, Iris didn't have to snap that hard, but she did, so she's going to get it.
You go, Iris.
The dialericity could be, like, the runners-up, because I feel like overall, across other shows of women not named Iris, that they stood out the most.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I approve this message. All right, thank you for tuning in. You can... obviously, send us all your feels and feedback through email, ladieswgumption@gmail.com. We're also available on Tumblr for all your thoughts, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. And we will see you again next week. I hope everyone has a happy Thanksgiving if you are celebrating. And until then, bye.
Bye.
Bye.